to open the public hearing on a whole bunch of bills. And these were pre-session filed bills. They're all on a very similar subject. And we have pretty much a presentation designed to go today. Former representative, now Marion County Commissioner Janet Carlson, will be leading off. And since how these were her bills, I think I will let her take over from here. Former representative, former committee staff person, one of the leading experts on children's issues in the state, actually. So good to see you again, Janet.
Thank you. Chair Cruz and members of the committee, I'm Janet Carlson. I am currently a Marion County Commissioner, former state representative from District 20 last session. And as Representative Cruz said, I have been a staff person at the State Commission on Children and Families. I was a member of the State Commission on Children and Families last session. I have been a consultant to local commissions on children and families. And most recently, Wednesday, I was named to the Marion County Local Commission on Children and Families as a member. So I've been involved with this in a lot of different hats and a lot of different roles. I wanted to also preface my remarks by saying that these were bills, as Representative Cruz said, that I pre-session filed during December at our joint committee meeting, Health and Human Services. So I am not here representing the Board of County Commissioners, although we have gone through the bills together and they know that I'm here and they support my being here. What I'd like to do first is give you an overview just of the children and family system. I know several of the representatives on the committee are new this session, and this may be something that you haven't had a lot of experience with, so I thought that I would just do a brief PowerPoint presentation and take your questions, and then I think we have proposed a reordering of the bills a bit for Representative Cruz so that the content would make a little bit more sense. The statutory area that we're looking at is ORS 417705 to 417797. And while I have 1993 to 2003, so we've been at this for 10 years now, the Children and Families Movement actually started a long time before that, started in the 1970s with a discussion about whether we were going to build a third state training school, believe it or not, and moved some of the dollars that would have been given to a training school to the counties, to juvenile services commissions for prevention. And then during the 80s, with Neil Goldschmidt's Children's Agenda, Great Start was added, Student Retention Initiative was moved over, Youth Conservation Corps, Child Care, a number of other funding streams were moved. And in 1993, a group called the Children's Care Team presented their report to the legislature. And Sandy has given you excerpts from that report for your reading. It is an excellent report. Craig Campbell was involved in putting it together. Speaker Larry Campbell, and they happen to be related, was really the driving force behind House Bill 2004 that came out of the Children's Care Team report. The chair of the committee during the 1993 session was a representative named Gene Durfler, and he took great ownership in this effort as well. It was a bipartisan effort. I want to emphasize that. They had equal numbers of senators and representatives, equal numbers of Republicans and Democrats. They had providers and advocates of children's services, business people who took a look at it from a little bit of a different slant than the social service providers did. And their mission, as it's stated there, is to design and implement an action plan for a more integrated, accessible, and preventive statewide system of services for children and their families in Oregon. Briefly, what they did was they took a look at the current system, and they determined that there were a number of challenges in the current system to folks who were trying to find services. Lots of different agencies providing services, lots of different rules governing the funds of different services, so people had to fill out multiple intake forms, sometimes couldn't get what they needed because of eligibility standards, often had to wait for services. And there was also this sense that if your budget was bigger or if you spent counseling time or seat time in school, that somehow that was an outcome, that you were able to prove success in your program by how much time was spent, rather than looking at the results of the services that were provided. They came up with a model, and this is my simplistic PowerPoint rendition of it, but you have a copy of the full model in your packet. The too little too late slide, that the idea that as you wait to provide services to people who are in need, the longer you wait, the likelihood of preserving a child's original potential goes down, and the cost and intensity of the treatment efforts go up. So it costs you more, and you're less likely to be successful, and that's the cost of waiting. When I was working with the Community Action several years ago, we came across a study, 1984 study, of a mid-Iowa Community Action Agency survey of former clients. And this gives you kind of a sense of what some of the problems are. First of all, when they surveyed their clients, they found that 75% of those clients were still at or below the poverty level, although community actions are designed to work with people who are in poverty. Second, of the other 25%, almost all were women who married someone with a decent job. So the director, the associate director, was quoted as saying, unless we were running a dating and mating service, we could hardly take credit for the improvement of the lives of these families. So what they did is they identified what the problem was. While their mission was to move people out of poverty, as an agency, they were not designed at that time to move people out of poverty. Rather, they were structured to deliver goods and services one unit at a time. And the same person that was quoted earlier said, we were a shopping list of services, each delivered in its own department with its own staff and its own boss. It was quite possible for a family using our services to have worked with six or seven different staff people, none of whom were talking to each other about the family. And I think we were seeing some of that here in Oregon 10 years ago. What they recommended was a systems approach and a family development approach, looking at the family as a system where each person influences another person in the family. Having services that involve respect, healing, and opportunity. Having voluntary services where people participate before they're in a crisis mode. Services at the home as opposed to making people go elsewhere for services. And looking at the relationships that people develop as they are working with other people. The idea of someone who cares versus just being triaged or referred to a service. And finally, the idea of doing family assessments, setting goals, and setting action plans. And I think that these, even though these principles were in a 1984 study, I think that they very well summarize the ideas that have really driven Oregon in our service integration through the Department of Human Services and in the Commission on Children and Families work doing coordinated comprehensive planning in communities. So why do we have local commissions on children and families? Well, this is a quote from statute. It says, under the direction of the board or boards of county commissioners, the main purposes of a local commission on children and families are three. One, to promote wellness, two, to mobilize communities, and three, to develop policy and oversee the implementation of a coordinated comprehensive plan. So I'm going to spend just a few minutes going through what each of those mean. First of all, what is wellness? Well, wellness was actually defined by the children's care team, and it came out of the business community, the idea of risk management. When we're looking in business at how you manage risk, you don't allow people to get injured on the job. Rather, you look at what kinds of chairs they're sitting in, how they're holding their hands when they type, whether you've got cords stretching across the cube, and that type of thing. Well, when you're looking at children and families, you don't wait until people are in crisis. You put prevention into place and look at preserving each child's potential. And so they came up with physical, social, emotional, cognitive, and cultural development as the aspects of wellness. The entire wellness system was a paradigm shift. I know that's sort of a trendy word, but the idea of changing what we think about services, rather than focusing, as I mentioned before, on inputs and process, looking at results and product. Delivering services at key touch points, and those would be the places where families naturally are. Two examples of that. One is Healthy Start. One of the things that research tells us is that families are more open to information about raising children when they have that first baby than any other time in the family's life. And so if we can connect with the family when they're having that first birth and provide information, provide connections to other parents, provide support, then we can reduce child abuse and neglect. We can reduce a number of other negative health outcomes for young children and their families. Another example of touch points would be when children start school. Parents are more interested in how their children do in school when their child enters kindergarten than at any other time in that child's school experience. In fact, I was a teacher for 10 years and taught at the junior high and high school levels. And you probably know that at parent nights, lots of parents come at elementary school, but by the time they get to the high school level, fewer and fewer parents come to parent night for their children. So interest kind of wanes as a child gets older. So there is a program called First Step that actually looks at the child's development as they enter kindergarten and tries to assess whether or not this child is going to have problems in terms of antisocial behavior and then is able to intervene so the child doesn't get involved in juvenile crime later on in their youth. Another aspect of the paradigm shift is supporting families rather than responding to crisis, promoting health and well-being rather than looking at fixing people with problems, and trying to get a handle on the variety of funding streams that we have that are restrictive and make them more coordinated. The second goal of a local commission on children and families of responsibility is to mobilize communities, and we could do a whole 2 hours just on what that means. But I think we've learned some things. First of all, community can be defined in many different ways. It can be a geographic area. It can be a social network. It can be a collective identity of, say, an ethnic or racial group. County, however, is not community, and we've learned that through our 10 years of experience. Marion County is not considered a community by the folks that live here. Generally, people consider their community either their town, if it's a small town, or in a large town, it tends to gravitate around their elementary or high school catchment area. So I live, for example, in the Pringle School area here in Salem, and we have a sense of community, and my kids go to Sprague, and when we root for the football and basketball teams, we have a sense of community there as well. Another thing that we've learned about mobilizing communities is that families and communities are interdependent, and this is actually in the statute as well. And I think that those that provide social services will tell you that they can work intensively with families, but if that child or family is in a community where there are drugs being sold, high criminality, high tolerance for smoking or for alcohol use, that quickly the intervention unravels when that family goes back into that community setting. So it's important that we look at healthy communities as well as healthy families. And finally, that social cohesion, or a lack of it, is a reliable predictor of juvenile crime. There's actually a study that comes out of Chicago that several years ago that is remarkable, that found that despite high poverty and other risk factors that you think would lead to juvenile crime, if a neighborhood had what they called social cohesion, which was that neighbors were willing to go out and tell kids, you know, settle down, don't put graffiti on the wall, they would talk to other parents and network, that actually juvenile crime was significantly lower in those neighborhoods, despite all the other things that you might think would lead to juvenile crime. We did a survey when I worked in Lane County, and we asked in the last 6 months, if you had a problem with your child, who did you seek help from? 54% said they went to a trusted friend, parent, or neighbor. 46% said they talked to their teacher at school or a counselor. 38% went to a family doctor or professional. 23% went to clergy. 8% went to a government-funded social service agency. So if we miss the whole community mobilization piece and only focus on the government-funded social service agencies, we're missing the boat in terms of preventing problems for children and families. I just wanted to briefly touch on the Search Institute assets. This is a movement that involves community mobilization that our county, Marion County, has been really involved in, and a number of other counties as well. But these are some examples of what they call external assets. These are things that communities and family can provide for kids. And then internal assets. So these are the internal results of providing those supports for youth. And there is a bill that, about youth development. Thank you. Okay, the last area is developing policy and overseeing the implementation of the coordinated comprehensive plan. And those we'll be talking about in depth during this presentation, so I won't go too much more into that at this time. The elements right now in statute of the coordinated comprehensive plan are these: a continuum of social supports for children 0 to 18 and their families, a range of civic, cultural, family support, and positive youth development activities, and then specifically an early childhood system plan, local alcohol and drug prevention plan, and a high-risk juvenile crime prevention plan. The coordinated comprehensive plans are also built around 19 high-level outcomes, and these are sort of shorthand for what those outcomes are. In Marion County and also in Douglas County, where I've worked, we've also looked at the goals and tried to connect those high-level outcomes with these four goals: strong, nurturing families, caring communities and systems, healthy, thriving children, and healthy, thriving youth. And these goals are actually taken from a research work on children and families that was done by Dr. Clara Pratt out of Oregon State University's Family Study Center. I provided these two slides, and I can't even remember where, to outline what counties needed to do to create their plan. look at trend data, fill in missing data, conduct surveys, hold forums, identify areas of special interest, services and activities, strengths and assets, community engagement, collaboration, age groups, special populations, overlaps, outreach, needs from the state. So you can see it was a very lengthy and involved process to develop the coordinated comprehensive plans that were turned into the state last year. Now, sometimes we forget, though, that there are still some elements in beyond planning in the law, the statutes that involve children and families. First of all, there is the requirement that we connect all state and local planning processes into a comprehensive plan. So it's not just the ones that are listed, it's all of them. Secondly, it's defining the local commission role to lead and coordinate the process that addresses strengths, needs, and assets of all children, families, and communities. So the commission's role is not to create the plan. The local commission's role is not to have all the money or have all the power or be in charge of all of the services in the county. The local commission's role is to be the convener, to be the facilitator, to bring all of the parties together to the same table and to work together on a plan that meets the needs of the community. And finally, there was an emphasis in the planning legislation on early childhood, developing an early childhood system, and on community mobilization, which I've already addressed. The 1993 elements that are still in Oregon law talk about a comprehensive continuum of services for all age groups, the realization that funding one age group or gender of children at the expense of another is destructive to the wellness of children. I think those are important pieces of the legislation. And that the service system must begin at the local level and be built on strengths and natural supports of neighborhoods and communities. In Marion County, I just wanted to end with a few slides. We have a group called the Family Systems Investment Consortium, and we've been working since 1998, have developed a memorandum of agreement amongst over 20 partners, county, state agencies, nonprofits, faith-based communities, education agencies. And when we met in 1998, I presented to them what the system might look like, what we might work on together. And a number of these things we've already done, but this will give you an idea of some of the things that can be done if people work together. First of all, coordinated planning. What if we could agree on one or more objectives where we could work together to build a more coherent system? Second, outcomes. What if we could agree on an outcomes framework so that we could compare our results across systems? The problem right now is that everybody sort of uses their own data collection plan, their own outcomes. They define them a little bit differently. We can't tell across counties, across different services, whether we're making a difference. Funding parameters. What if we agreed on a request for proposal form and timeline that was the same for all funders? So in Marion County, United Way, the City of Salem, Marion County Children and Families Commission, and Community Action Agency are all using a common grant application form so people that write for money don't have to use three different or four different budget formats, four different sets of questions, and so on. So it saves them time and effort as well. Data and technology. What if we could agree on one intake form? What if we knew each other's email addresses? So it goes from the sublime to the, not ridiculous, but the very, you know, the very practical. What if we agreed to certain agencies being responsible for maintaining current referral information? And in Marion County, we now have a crisis hotline and a warm line. Oops. And what if we shared best practices, joint training, shared assessments, and tools for cultural competency, case management, family support, and other quality issues? Training and bringing service providers together is really important. And I already mentioned family access. What if we agreed to certain agencies staffing a countywide crisis hotline or a parenting warm line? So these are the steps that we've gone through, and you'll hear a lot more about them today. First of all, communities and stakeholders have worked very hard to develop plans, coordinated comprehensive plans. The Board of Commissioners have approved all 36 plans and submitted them to a state team for review, and that happened in early 2002. We just completed a measurement component that was due January 31st of this year, and now we're looking at the governor's budget and looking to the 2003 legislative session to bring to you the results of those plans and to also talk about what can make life easier for communities and service providers and integration of services in a time when, frankly, people in communities are feeling pretty beat up, as I'm sure you hear, with the various budget cuts that have gone on. I know that at the county level, we've had to make some very difficult choices. Some of them are driven by what's happening at the state level in terms of reductions to public health, mental health, community corrections. Education is suffering, higher education is suffering, and it's difficult at this time to be able to say, well, let's move forward with a coordinated system and let's do planning. I think if I could leave you with one thought about that, it is that in times of tight resources, I just think it's more important than ever for us to work together. We don't have the luxury of having separate agencies, each sort of in their own little world, doing their own little thing. We've got to be able to pull things together if we're going to be able to sustain any level of services for children and families in our communities. So with that, I'll open to any questions that you might have.
Questions? Yes, Representative Tomac.
Good to see you, Jen.
Hi.
Jen, this involves quite a few agencies. Have they been involved in the process of developing these bills?
Well, let me tell you, that was one of the things I was going to talk about after questions, so that's a great segue. The way that these bills were developed is that last summer, and I think in August, a group of local commission folks, Legislative Committee of the Coalition of Children and Families Commissions, came together for a day to brainstorm ideas about bills. And so these ideas went up on the chart, bringing more agencies into the planning effort, and we'll talk about kind of the reasons for why on that, looking at some of the challenges that we had in the planning process, and also looking at the themes that were coming out of the comprehensive plans, because we were starting to get, the state was compiling all of the results of those plans, and family support, for example, was one broad theme. I think it was in about 28 of the plans. Youth development was another theme that was listed in a number of plans as well. So looking at bills that might address those different areas.
Janet, so who were the people involved in that?
Those were local commission directors primarily, and then I also invited Jean Lassiter, who has worked with the Homeless Coalition, and she invited Janet Ahrens. Right. And so it was a group probably about, I'm thinking, maybe 15 people. Did you say 15 people, 20 people that day? Okay, so that was where we brainstormed the original ideas for the bills. Let me finish, though, okay? So then they proposed that they go out to the counties for feedback. And the executive committee took a look at them, didn't take a position on them, sent them out to the counties for feedback. And since this was a new process that we had never, as local commissions on children and families, actually been proactive before in presenting bills, we had actually sort of reacted to bills either that the governor had presented or budget mostly had been our focus. We thought this would be an interesting thing to do. However, we realized that if any county felt a little bit uncomfortable with it, it wouldn't be a good thing to do because we didn't want to put the name of local commissions on the bills if there was any county that had an objection. So at the time that we sent them out to the counties, there were I think only about 9 counties that responded within the time frame. Some said they needed a lot of additional information. Some supported some concepts, didn't support others. The county I'm from, Marion County, endorsed all of the bills, as did Douglas County, where I've done some work. And I think Deschutes County endorsed all the bills. Most were the 3 counties that endorsed them, and then others had, you know, varying feedback. So given that, we decided, as we had agreed initially, that we wouldn't go forward on them. So then I decided to put them in as pre-session filed bills. In terms of the work with CLO, local health and mental health organizations, I worked with Gordon Fultz and with Gina Furman, and they're still working with their organizations on getting information to them. We provided them with copies early on and asked for their input, and I have continually asked them, you know, if they have ideas for changes, for, you know, amendments, language that they can support, and I'm more than open to work with them on that. And we'll be talking about that when we get to 2120, which I think is the bill that they'll be focusing on today. Does that get to what you needed to know?
Maybe. We'll have more questions later. Thanks.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Carlson, I thank you for a very good presentation. I was interested in your Lane County survey and the percentages here of trusted friend and parent, neighbor, and family doctor, professional, clergy seem to comprise a heavy majority of people that the kids would go to. Is that a good reason for us to be looking at contracting some of these out more to the private side to get it closer and more down to the ground level where the people would normally go to, families and children?
Well, Representative Cruz and Representative Anderson, I think what it tells us, first of all, is that, I do believe there is a role, obviously, for social services. And if you look at the percentages of the population that are in poverty or at higher risk, it correlates pretty closely to that 8 to 10% of people that turn to the government-funded social service agencies. But I think what the survey told me, anyway, is that things aren't static, that people may have a job and then all of a sudden not have a job, mm-hmm. and particularly in these times. And those kinds of dynamics can influence whether people are involved with alcoholism, whether they get in fights with their family, whether or not they get depressed and perhaps suicidal. So anybody can go from a situation where things seem to be fine to a situation where they're not fine. And the problem is that if we look only at the government portion in terms of how we bridge things together, we're missing the boat. And so what we need to do is look at all of the services that we have, whether they be through nonprofit organizations, whether they be through service clubs, whether they be through churches, or whether they be through the more traditional government sector, and we need to pull those together and work together. So contracting out services, I think, for example, in the faith-based arena, we've had a number of discussions. I had a line in a bill last session that dealt with faith-based communities that made them very, very nervous because they said they could not in any way meet the needs of the numbers of people that would come through the service system if you tried to contract out to churches, for example. But I think it's more a message of needing all the different sectors from prevention all the way through treatment to be more connected and work together.
The reason I scheduled all of these today and specifically just for public hearing is this is part of a larger picture that we will be looking at, and part of the work around this agenda will probably happen in Representative Westland's audit committee. It's, you know, this is a piece of service delivery that we're going to have to take a hard look at and find ways of restructuring and economizing to make sure that in these very difficult economic times we're able to deliver the biggest bang for the buck as far as the services we deliver to the people of Oregon. And I personally see the commissions as being an integral part of that delivery modality. So this is the beginning of a discussion that's clearly not the end. So who's next?
Representative Cruz, we thought we would have the bill about parenting, House Bill 2126, sure. as the first presentation if there are no further questions.
Good job. Okay. Nina Lee Sachs. And let's call up Linda Craven same time, if that would be okay. Yeah, Linda Craven. Can you come up too? We got a lot of stuff to get through, so I'm going to kind of tag team these things. So try not to fight with each other when you're okay.
We're friends.
I'm not going to put a for and against on the same on the same table, so I think we're okay here. Please go ahead. Now, and everybody that's testifying, remember you need to identify yourself for the record, basically your name. It's one of our rules, so please go ahead.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, I'm Nina Lee Sachs. I'm executive director of Birth to Three. And I'm here to give my strong endorsement, to House Bill 2126 to help ensure that families are going to get the kind of quality program and services that they need more than ever right now. I'm speaking to you as the founder and executive director of Birth to Three, which is a parenting, education, and support program that began in Lane County in 1978. Today, this program is a national model, and more than 400 sites around the country are using our Make Parenting a Pleasure curriculum to help to strengthen families. It's also being used in four other countries. And in the country of Romania, it's helping to prevent children from being abandoned and to strengthen families so that the children are able to remain with their families there. I'm currently meeting and will be meeting again in April with representatives from UNICEF because they believe that the model that we've started right here is important enough to be used in other countries in addition to the four where they already are. And I'm telling you this because meanwhile, back home in Oregon, the only significant ongoing funding for this program has been lost through Measure 28, the downfall of Measure 28. And we know, through all the reading that we do, that the value of parenting education and support is beyond any kinds of argument. All of the research on infant brain development in the early years show us how very important good parenting is to a child being able to develop cognitively, physically, their health, and their just being able to be contributing members of society. And at the same time that we know how important parenting is, we also see the need for parent support and education and family support growing as more parents are living with the stresses of this tough economy and uncertain times. We know that child abuse rates are unacceptable, and in Lane County, at least, the rates are continuing to rise. House Bill 2126 will help Oregon families in a fundamental way. It will assure that resources go to programs that work. And in these times of scarce and disappearing resources, it's critical that family support programs throughout Oregon use the models and the curricula that have demonstrated that they're the best practice and that they're effective. We can't afford programs that don't work. In the year 2000, the Oregon Office of Drug and Alcohol Abuse Program, which is now part of Department of Human Services, went through an intensive process to identify best practice parenting programs in Oregon. And the state selected several model programs, and at that time they paid for training and they paid for curricula to be disseminated to some of the programs and sites within Oregon. And in addition to our Make Parenting a Pleasure program, there are others selected that included one called Strengthening Multi-Ethnic Families, Preparing for the Drug-Free Years, and several others. We also know that there's other just excellent programs here in Oregon. The Relief Nursery is one. And there's also one called The Incredible Years, developed out of the University of Washington. These are all programs that have been proven to be excellent. There's many models to prove from, to choose from. And one of the most well-known resources to find these programs, in addition to the selection process that's gone on in our own state, is the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. We know that parenting programs can save lives and they can build communities. And I can just tell you from my own experience that I led a group with a 17-year-old mom who, when she was 16, found out she was pregnant, married her high school sweetheart, at 17 found herself as a widow with a baby, and in a home that was a little apartment in Springfield where she kept the blinds drawn and didn't speak to anyone and was drinking too much, until a neighbor reached out to her, and this is what Janet was saying about community and about neighbors, brought her to a Make Parenting a Pleasure program where she said for the first time people weren't telling her she was doing things wrong, where she was treated with respect, where she was able to help others, where she kept her dignity, and where she said, I learned how to be a good mom. I learned how to love my child. And this is a woman who today has a 15-year-old little boy who is doing great in high school, who's on the soccer team, and she herself went through and got a master's degree and is now working in early intervention. But she says that, you know, you might think that for moms like me that we would have made it anyway without these kinds of family support programs, but it's just not true. She said that there was another road that she was about to head down, and because she got what she needed, it made all the difference. Just briefly, I want to tell you, too, about a program that Make Parenting a Pleasure has done in collaboration with St. Vincent de Paul, where we've been able to work with families coming out of homelessness, moving into transitional housing, and together, a group who will be living together takes this parenting class and gets the support. And at the beginning of the program, one of the dads said, if another parent in this group had said anything to my kids, I would have got out my shotgun. That's what he said. At the end, he said, but now we all help each other. We watch each other's children. we're there for each other because we all want the same things. So it's really building community. The last thing I wanted to tell you about that potential is that because Birth to Three has been around a long time, we've gotten to see results. And 7 years ago, we had a reunion of the first babies and parents that were ever in Birth to Three groups that had started in 1978. Now the babies were graduating from high school. And so we brought them together for a reunion, and we heard the stories that they had to tell us about how starting out and getting support at the beginning created lifetime connections for those families and how they helped each other through so many crises and through so many of life's really tough times. And story after story, and I know that I continue to hear this daily, you know, from people. I was in a group 8 years ago, 2 years ago, 12 years ago, you know, and like one of the moms said that when she was hospitalized, that she had a three-month-old baby, she couldn't, when she got home from the hospital, she couldn't walk, she couldn't lift her baby. She'd had a peritonitis and was in the hospital for 5 days, and she couldn't do anything. And it was her group that came in and brought her her baby. They watched the baby. They cleaned the house. They brought in the food. And she was able to keep nursing because she had that support. It's just hard to even put any kind of dollar figures to those kinds of things. So I brought you a few things, and one of them is a copy of an article that I think you will enjoy. It's called From Diapers to Diplomas, and it talks about that reunion I was talking about with the first graduating class. And I guess the last thing I just want to say is that these examples that I gave are just from one program. We have other excellent programs here in Oregon. But the important thing is we don't have very many dollars, we don't have very many resources, and we need to be sure that whatever is being used has been proven and effective so that families can get what they need, especially right now. 2126 is an important step to help us get there. I really appreciate your listening. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Representative Bob.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, did you say relief nurseries were unique to Oregon?
The particular model of relief nursery has started in Oregon, also in Eugene, as has Birth to Three. What do I do with these? Shall I wait until she goes?
No, that'd be fine. You can give them to her, and we'll get them distributed.
I'm sorry? From Birth to Three?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Linda Craven. I'm an instructor at Chemeketa Community College in early childhood education, and I serve as a member of the board of directors for Family Building Blocks, a crisis relief nursery here in Salem, Oregon. And we are based on the model of the Eugene Relief Nursery, the Lane County Relief Nursery. There are seven of us in Oregon, seven relief nurseries in Oregon. And I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 2126, the parent education bill. I'm going to look at it from some of the things that the crisis relief nurseries do and how important that parent education component is in creating healthy and safe families. The crisis relief nurseries in Oregon serve the highest risk families in our state. Relief nurseries' work is focused on two things, keeping children safe and families together. And when we look at the families that we serve, we see that we have families with multiple risk factors, such as poverty, drug and alcohol involvement in the criminal justice system, domestic violence history, a history of child abuse in their background, mental illness, and low education. Many of these children have grown up in families that are similar to the families they are now in. They then bring babies into very difficult and very, very hostile environments at times. The maltreatment of these children really affects the entire society. But what we know from brain research, as Minna Lee was also saying, is that it does profoundly alter the brain of the child. We know, for example, studies, Professor Craig Ramey at the University of Alabama says that the quality of the environment and the kind of experiences that children have in their very early years may affect brain structure and functioning so profoundly They may not be correctable after age 5. So we're talking about a very limited amount of time to create healthy families and to help parents to be good parents. The relief nurseries consist of some core programs, and each relief nursery has sort of a different set of programs. Here in Salem at Family Building Blocks, for example, our core programs consist of therapeutic classrooms where children 6 weeks to 5 years attend. They are taught in those classrooms skills that promote social, emotional, physical, and cognitive development. They learn language skills, problem solving, and they sense that they are important in their life. We have a respite classroom for families that are on our waiting list and not able to get into therapeutic classrooms. The respite classroom is for parents who need a break, and those children need a safe environment so that the parents have a break and the child is in a safe environment. We have parent education. We have monthly parent nights. We have parent education that is ongoing on a weekly basis and a variety of different parent ed programs. Home visits. All of the children in therapeutic classrooms receive a home visit, either weekly or monthly, depending on the amount of crisis, the need of the family. Those core programs, as you see, involve both the child and the family. This is because many of the studies that we have, and one of the most important studies that we've used, is looking at a longitudinal study done by Child Haven in the Seattle area. And Child Haven did a 12-year longitudinal follow-up study looking at families who started in a crisis relief nursery type of program, and then 12 years later looking at those families. And what we found is the importance of the parent component and the child component, putting those two elements together, are absolutely vital. A good, solid parenting program has to be a part of creating a healthy family system. One of the outcomes, interestingly enough, that this longitudinal study said, and it may seem obvious, but when teachers went into the home, when home visitors went into the home and began to speak to the parents about what a kind, lovely, smart, caring, great kid they had, the parents began to readjust their attitude and see the child from that perspective. They began to value the things that they were talked about, that your child is so smart. Look at this great drawing your child did. And the parent began to see that and began to value that. Seems kind of obvious, but that was an important thing. It also was helpful because it helped the parents then to begin to create an environment in the home that promoted cognitive and social and emotional development.
Excuse me, Representative Dalton has a question.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. To which study were you referring?
It's Child Haven, which is a relief nursery out of Seattle, and it's a 12-year longitudinal study, and it was published. It was published in Child Maltreatment Magazine of February of 98.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks. So this study.
Sorry, Child Maltreatment Magazine?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I know. It doesn't. It really is.
Okay, thanks. What a society we live in.
I understand. But this 12-year study has really helped us to look at we must have a combination of child and the parent education program. The only way to create a quality environment is to help parents be better parents. And to help parents be better parents, we have to teach them basic skills. Many of the parents that come in and enter Family Building Blocks, for example, have a difficult time understanding that it's okay to pick the baby up when the baby cries. They've been told that this may not be a positive thing, that they may be spoiling their child. And what they start to learn is responding to basic needs of the child is not a bad thing, it's a good thing. Seeing the teacher show and model how to pick up the baby, giving the parent an opportunity in the home to learn and feel comfortable picking up the baby is a part of what creates that attachment and bonding that is so important. And that's part of what we're talking about when we're talking about under the age of 5 is the attachment and bonding. Brain research has proven that when a young child's brain adapts to neglectful and abusive environments, the environmentally induced change that take place can become permanent in the brain. This permanent change can encode a propensity towards violence, and it can last a lifetime. So we know, and that's from Inside the Brain, written by Ronald Kotelek. These future parents will continue the cycle of poor parenting. And so House Bill 2126 allows the idea, gives us the hope that by helping with parent education, by infusing it, and as we do at crisis relief nurseries, in meetings, in family nights, in home visits, in the respite nursery, and helping children to feel good about themselves, we may have a chance then to get rid of that cycle of poor parenting that just goes on and on. One of the best quotes I've ever heard, and I just carry it around as sort of as a relief nursery slogan, W.R. Ng said, "The best time to influence the character of a child is 100 years before they're born." I can't think of any better way to do that than parent education. Thank you. Any questions?
Any questions? Representative Tomac.
Thank you. Glenda, I'm just very supportive of your program. I just think it's wonderful. I think your philosophy is right on. But I'm somewhat confused. How is it that this bill is going to aid your program?
Anytime. I mean, the point of a crisis relief nursery, we'd like to not have crisis relief nurseries. So the idea of a good parenting program, quality parenting programs, quality parent education, is going to help to promote quality parenting skills. And for relief nurseries, all that does is really support what we have been doing and a place for us to continue to house parent education, a place for us to continue to house good parent education.
I'm still somewhat confused. And looking at the bill, I can't see where it directly promotes family education.
No,
are
I'm talking
bill in front of you?
I'm talking about the parent ed, just promoting parent education. And I'm looking at
provide parent education. How would it provide parent education? I guess I'm clear about that.
I'm sorry.
How would it provide parent education?
I think all I'm doing is supporting the idea of parent education,
right.
That we could not be doing the job that we're doing in the crisis relief nursery without parent education.
Right.
And if we continue to use parent education as sort of a prevention mode instead of, you know, in the crisis mode, we may not have the need for the crisis relief nurseries that we do. Did that make sense?
Yeah. Well, both said, yeah. But I guess I'm not exactly sure how it provides that, but maybe we can deal with that later.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I can't
answer
that.
Fine. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In committee, I will have to admit that I've only been to 5 of the 7 relief nurseries, so.
Five.
And I believe there's going to be a legislative open house sort of thing.
February the 12th?
Yes.
At 2425 Lancaster Drive.
Yeah.
Chelsea's Place, Family Building Block.
My car.
5:30, I think?
Yeah. So,
yeah, we invite you all.
Thank you.
Okay. Pauline Martell and Sarah McDonald. Nice to see you, Pauline.
Nice to see you as well, Representative Cruz. Representative Cruz and members of the committee, you have heard about some best practice programs today from Ms. Sachs and Ms. Craven. And the handout that I provided for you gives you a little overview of core components of those programs. But I'm more here to talk about community coordination and community planning, which is addressed in House Bill 2126. And hopefully, Representative Tomei, this will help address the question you had earlier. The importance to me about House Bill 2126 is the concept of community planning on a broad expanse across a county.
as you heard earlier, a county is not a community. There are multiple communities within a county. And one of the things that we have done across the board, nationally even, is look at what feels good in helping preventive efforts as opposed to what actually works. And the programs that you've heard about today so far are programs that actually have research-based as best practices and are supported by the National Center for Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse Prevention and also other prevention programs throughout the state and the nation. It's important, I think, to recognize that multiple partners...
Pauline,
yes.
Did you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes,
could
I did not.
That?
Pauline Martell. I am the Director of Prevention and Training with ADAPT, which is an alcohol and other drug prevention and training program in Roseburg, Oregon, Douglas County.
Okay. Thank you.
I've all of us been in education. I was formerly an educator, and I have been a parent trainer. And I've worked with Douglas County Commission on Children and Families for all the years in which it has existed in working to coordinate community efforts. One of the things that I think is very important about coordinated efforts in a community in best practices is that each organization works with each other in order to provide parenting best practice programs. One of the ways that we're doing this in Douglas County is not only are we providing best practice programs, but we are coordinating our data collection efforts, and we are coordinating our evaluation efforts and post questionnaires for parents to talk about what worked well for them so that we can continue to improve programs in the county. House Bill 2126 addresses under Section 4 model programs. So that is to what I'm speaking. In addition, it also talks about linking and integrating family support services with local comprehensive plans, which is, I think, probably one of the most important pieces of this legislation. In Douglas County, we have programs like the Community Action Network, the Crisis Relief Center, the Service Provision for Prevention in Schools, and also treatment services using the same best practice programs to provide parenting enhancement and support. In addition, with best practice programming coordination, there is an assurance of efficacy of delivery. And whenever we look at a best practice program, we want to be assured that all trainers are trained in the same way and are delivering the materials in the same way so that there is comprehensive improvement across the communities. Multiple partners working together certainly are addressed in House Bill 2126 and is the main reason that I'm supporting this program or this House bill. If there are questions that you would have for me at this time, I would be happy to answer them. Thank you. Let me have here. Could you identify yourself?
I'm Sarah McDonald. I'm the director of the Josephine County Commission for Children and Families.
Oh, I'm sorry. Before I was taken off guard, friends. Do we have any questions, Pauline? Sorry. Seeing none. Thank you.
I'm actually here today to read a letter that was sent to you from the director of our Family Resource Center, or one of our Family Resource Centers in Josephine County, the Coalition for Kids Incorporated. Use my glasses, sorry. The Coalition for Kids.
Who's the letter from?
Debbie Cantiello, the director of the Josephine County, the Grants Pass Coalition for Kids Incorporated. The Coalition for Kids has owned and operated the Family Resource Center for 13 years. It works with a host of community agencies and to provide comprehensive programs, family support programs, and children programs. HB 2126 in Section 4 speaks to the need for family support services for children and families in Oregon. As our funding challenges continue to grow, it will be even more important that the state and local commissions for children and families continue to work with all available agencies to provide comprehensive service to and for our children. This bill provides excellent guidance for the local commission while maintaining the flexibility necessary to enable local control and specific direction to be established by each community. Coalition for Kids has the distinction of being the first family resource center in the state to receive funding as a demonstration project in 1991 and has been the subject of several evaluation projects since that time. So the Coalition is a private nonprofit program, and they've enjoyed broad-based community support. In 1994, with the help of the Josephine County Commission for Children, they started a parenting program. Our dream was to provide ongoing year-round parenting classes to any parent who wanted to attend. In 9 years since we have started, we have never turned a parent away for inability to pay and have averaged 7 classes per year and 150 parents. Some of our parents are court mandated, some are teen parents, many and a growing number in our community are grandparents who are raising children for the second time. And some are parents like Debbie Cantell, the director, and her husband, whose children are now teenagers and wondering why an instruction manual never came with those children. They want to thank you for their time and stress the importance of parenting education as a strong preventative effort and a way to encourage families to work together. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Any questions?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Not a question so much as a comment that Coalition in Grants Pass has been a wonderful addition to our community. Took an old school that had been vacated and put in each classroom different functions, everything from legal aid to Head Start, some different child care outfits. And it's been a wonderful success in our community, not because of public funds, although those are needed. But the community has really jumped in, and being a 501c3, they've contributed huge amounts to a very successful program. And the teen and the parenting, not only the teen parenting, but the parenting classes have been extremely helpful in the community. We are one of the least prosperous counties in the state, and as a result have many needs for families that are really very indigent, and so it's a program that really has been very successful in our community.
Thank you, Gordon. Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, ladies. Terry Urbane, is that right? And Annie Carlson? Could you state your name for the record, please?
Good morning. I'm Terry Urban. I reside at 930 Tamarack, Northeast in Salem, Oregon. And actually, I'm here on behalf of Vicki Ertel. She was unable to be here this morning. And just a little about myself, I am director of 4 community learning centers in Salem, Oregon, so I feel very honored to be able to read this for Vicki on her behalf. For the record, my name is Vicki Ertel, 1010 Northwest 14th Street, Bend, Oregon. I am executive director of the Central Oregon Family Resource Center, a community nonprofit providing parent education and family skills training services to the families of Deschutes County since 1990. I'm also representing the Deschutes County Professional Advisory Council, comprised of 24 community organizations helping children and families. The Professional Advisory Council serves in an advisory capacity to the Deschutes County Commission on Children and Families. I'm president. Co-chair of the council. Prior to my work in Deschutes County, I spent 10 years in educational research and development with an emphasis on drug and alcohol prevention, family involvement, and community collaboration. Because of an existing board of directors meeting this morning, February 3rd, I am unable to testify in person and want to thank you for considering my written testimony in my absence. I urge you to move forward with House Bill 2126 for the following reasons and also offer a few suggested changes. Reasons for support. Number one, being an effective parent is not an inherent or built-in skill. In fact, most people pattern parenting styles based on their family of origin. If these families included addiction, child abuse, or incarceration, generations of poor parenting will often continue. As we know from the number of children involved with child protective services in the juvenile justice system, this can be socially, financially, and emotionally costly. Current research on effective parenting practices provides clear evidence that teaching parents family management skills does not make a difference in healthy child outcomes. The current research also provides a roadmap of strategies and model programs that are already being implemented in programs around the nation and the state. HB 2126 is a means for Oregon to develop leadership and a vision that will support parent-scale building efforts throughout the state, urban to rural. It is appropriate for the state to initiate a task force to study all aspects of parent education and family skill building to ensure that funds targeted to this effort are spent in the most judicious and prudent manner. Number two, HB 2126 meets the general intent of a 2003-2005 legislative priority adopted in November 2002 by the Deschutes County Professional Advisory Council. Priority E, a focus on positive parenting, stated the goal, quote, to establish a statewide policy that promotes positive parenting, documents best practice concepts in programming, and identifies proven and promising programs in Oregon and the nation, end of quote. The council proposed a time-limited statewide task force to conduct a thorough analysis and report findings and recommendations to the 2005 Oregon legislature. Similar wording is found in HB 2126. Two, considerable work in model program development has already been done in Oregon and or is currently being implemented. The citizens of Oregon will benefit from HB 2126, which will bring this body of work and experience together in a coordinated and purposeful effort. Much of this work is already being conducted by local commissions and their community partners. The State Commission on Children and Families already has the capacity to bring it together. This work includes, one, in Deschutes County, the Central Oregon Family Resource Center's Family Track System, as well as early childhood programs including Together for Children and Ready, Set, Go. Two, the Ford Families Foundations in Roseburg, enhancing the skills of parents. Three-year initiative currently supporting family supportive services in 10 rural Oregon communities with technical assistance from Oregon State University. And three, the Portland-based innovative partnership with a current focus area on parenting education and training support for parent educators throughout the state. These are only three examples of existing work. Suggested revisions. To increase the timeliness, efficiency, and financial implications of HB 2126, I offer the following recommended changes. Page 4, Section 4, Subsection 1A, add parents, institutes of higher education, universities and community colleges, private nonprofits and private foundations to the list in entities the State Commission on Children and Family and local commissions shall consult and work with. This addition will ensure that all Oregon providers, researchers, and funders will have an equal opportunity to participate and contribute to the successful implementation of HB 2126. In closing, thank you for the opportunity to provide written testimony, and Vicki Ertl may be reached at 541-389-5468. I thank you on behalf of Vicki, and I also support this House bill. I don't know if you have any questions or if I can answer them.
No questions. Thank you very much.
Okay. Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Annie Carlson. I am the Parent Education Coordinator for Silverton Together, which is a community progress team for the entire Silver Falls School District. When we first came together as a community progress team 9 years ago, we did an assessment of our small community looking for both strengths and weaknesses. What did our community lack? What did our community already have? One thing we found was that there was no real program of parent education. And from all the research that we were aware of, we knew that this was a real foundation or building block for healthy communities and healthy children. The only thing that was offered was perhaps once a year a church might offer a love and logic class, or the next year the schools might offer a specific class that one teacher got excited about. There was no coordinated effort, no comprehensive program. We decided to make this a priority in our community. We started 6 years ago with a $5,000 grant from Title V funds. And did some research. We went down to Eugene to Mentally Sachs's program. Mentally Sachs was the first person who testified here this morning, and were just blown away by what they were doing in Eugene with their new parent programs, with the programs that brought together first-time parents with their babies. and we wanted to do the same thing. We took people down, we visited, we brought people up, got trained, and started ourselves. One of our very first classes recently held there. They came together when their babies were 0 to 3 months of age. Their children just entered kindergarten. The group is still together, still meeting monthly, had a great big bang before school started in September to send their children off to kindergarten. We now offer that particular class 4 times a year so that every 3 months there is a new group that first-time parents can roll into. We started with that one because that was our best bang for the buck. All the research tells us that getting those parents at that critical moment, first time their lives have turned topsy-turvy with this new presence in their lives, was the time to reach them, and it has proven true. Those parents are total advocates of parent education. They take one class, they want the next. What's next? What's next? They are the ones who have been pushing us to keep adding pieces to our to what's offered in Silverton. We've added a toddler program. And many other pieces, including a teen parent program, a class for Spanish-speaking parents, and other different populations. We now have 10 different programs offered throughout the year. In the beginning, we were beating the streets for participants. Now all of our classes are overflowing. Parents who graduate from one, as I say, are clamoring for the next. Silverton has become a community in which parent education is the norm, preventive parent education. The mistaken idea that it's only bad parents who take parenting classes has been erased. Once parents experience the support that they receive in this kind of class, it's not just the curriculum, it's not just the skills, which are incredibly important, but it's the support network that's established in those classes that that keeps them coming back for more and which provides an incredible preventive support network for their entire lives as parents. They bond over sharing the birth experiences of their first child. The next time, or when they're in stress over whether it's something with their child or not, they have 12 people who are incredibly bonded with them that they can call upon. During Janet's presentation, she showed that, 50 or 60% of the time people will turn to a family or a close friend. Some people don't have family here. Some people don't have close friends, but a program like this instantly makes that possibility, even for people who didn't have it before. The feedback from parents has been incredible, constantly here. Don't know what we would have done without it. In the Spanish-speaking class that we're running for the third time this year, we heard from many of the Latinos that they felt very isolated in our community before this class. One of the comments was, before this, I had no friends. Now I have 10. Feedback regarding parenting skills, something as heartbreaking as, I used to hit my child. I didn't know what else to do. Now I know I have choices, over and over again. In our teen parents, that's been incredible too. One of the comments from one of our young girls last year, this class showed me how to enjoy being a parent, but also helped me know I was important and competent. I am now enrolled in Chemeketa and wouldn't have done that without the support I received here. We could not have done this without the original money we received from the government. We used that minimal amount, $5,000, to leverage a whole lot more community support, and we continue to do so. We do all kinds of partnering within the community. The hospital, Silverton Hospital, provides the space and the refreshments for our Parents Infants Plus class, and also the opportunity to promote the class at their childbirth classes. Speakers for that class have come from Chemeketa, from the fire department to teach CPR. The hospital's massage therapist comes and teaches infant massage. The teen parent class is held in a local church. Snacks come are donated or at a discount from local restaurants and stores. We use the city trolley to provide free transportation to our Spanish-speaking class because some of those families aren't able to make it without that, and get a volunteer from the community who gives his time to pick folks up and bring them back every Thursday for that class. Child care assistance. childcare is always supervised by a professional caregiver, but we need more bodies in there, and they come from local Girl Scout troops and high school clubs. We partner with Marion County Health Department for two of our classes with their trained facilitators. Now, we learned from Birth to Three. Birth to Three could not have trained us without the government money that they received to be able to educate others about the fantastic program that they have. We are happy to pass it on. We have been contacted by many other small communities like ours. How do you do it? How do you get people to your classes? How do you provide that many within your community? We tell them how we do it, but many don't have they don't have the funds, first off, to hire somebody to actually oversee this and do this. It does take some money. We would love to see this replicated in other small communities. We have been able to take parents from outside our community when we were first getting started. We're at the point now we can't do that. We haven't turned anybody away yet, but we're getting to the point where we're going to have to say, sorry, Silverton folks only. So we would love to see this in Woodburn, in Staten, all around us, all of the communities who have expressed effort or wanting to make that effort. We've had people move to town because of their experience in the class. They heard about it through the childbirth class, and they were delivering at Silverton Hospital, but they lived in Salem or elsewhere because of their experience and the support they received in that class with their new babies. They wanted to come to town and be a part of that community. And we can't keep taking folks. We're getting in trouble with all the folks who want managed growth in Silverton. So we need this kind of coordinated effort throughout the state. Local communities know how to make this happen if there is some support and coordination involved. So I am heartily in support of HB 2126, and thank you for your time. Any questions?
Representative Tomei.
And it sounds like an incredible program. You must be very proud of it. Is it your understanding that this bill would carry funds with it to start up programs similar to this in other communities?
Well, I would hope there would be some funds. If not, just the coordinated support would be very helpful. We received that from the Commission on Children and Families, our local children and families, when we were first starting. And to even just to have that coordinated support and contact with, for example, the health department, et cetera, has been very, very valuable.
Great. Thank you so much, Ann.
And committee, this bill does have a subsequent referral.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Eddie Jones and Janet Carlson. Eddie, I know you came to give the testimony that was, or read the letter that was previously read, so if you could kind of summarize, it would be helpful.
Yes, I can. And thank you very much, Representative Cruz and the committee. I did arrive late, so I appreciate the chance to have a chance to say a few words. I am Edie Jones, and I am here to ask your support of House Bill 2126. I come representing the children and families of Deschutes County and Central Oregon, and through the Professional Advisory Council, the Central Oregon Not-for-Profit Family Resource Center, and the Oregon chapter or Oregon piece of Together for Children. I am the director of the Together for Children program. I am a seasoned veteran parent educator, having been in the work for about 14 years. I am also the former owner and director of Camp Tamarack, where it brought me in contact with many, many children and their families. I also have a master's in adult education, which I think leads me to speak particularly about Section 4 of House Bill 2126. This is a very good bill. This is an important bill. Primarily, it lays out the work of the Commission of Children and Families from the State Commission down to the County Commission and their work with the County Commissioners and all of the other agencies in the communities. It gives them real clear direction as to how to operate, and that is why it is a very good bill. The amendments that are being proposed will make it even better. The part I'd like to speak about is the Section 4, which talks about the need for study, research, analysis, evaluations of the programs that are in place. This is a very important piece, a very important thing to have happen. It sounds like it could be expensive, but it does not need to be expensive at all. I think you've been hearing from many people this morning of the work that is being done around the state, of the wonderful programs that are being already happening and have been happening over the years, and the research and the material that is already there. Every single year we evaluate, and we have data from our program, which has been here for 14 years. There are many personal stories. Representative Westland dropped by my program one time, and I think he thought he'd stay for about 5 minutes, and my parents kept him captivated for about 20 or 25 minutes telling him what was happening in our program. Senator
being an ADD, quite an accomplishment.
Senator Clarnell stopped by at one time, and she ended up holding a baby who was crying because mom was gone down to the parenthood part of the program, and that baby was a little distraught. And Senator Clarnell was wonderful, and I think Together for Children became a very important piece for her at that time. But this particular part of the bill talks about the need for research and study. That is already happening. There are many, many people in our state who can be a part of that task force, and I encourage you to adopt that and to use the people who are here, use the county commission for children and families, which are already in place, put them to work and use the work that has been done so that we do not need to spend any more funds. So those funds can go to direct services to the families and the children that need them, because the commissions can work very closely together, a lot of coordination, very efficiently, very effectively. And if Deschutes County is an example of what happens around the state, I think you will have very, very good work done. This is really a very good bill. It's a very important bill, and I encourage you to support it. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I just wanted to add from a statutory perspective, because there's been a number of questions, what's different about this bill or what this bill would do. First of all, the bill defines family support services in statute. Currently, family support is defined only as it relates to disabilities. It is not defined as it relates to family strengthening programs like you've heard about today. There was actually some conversation during the comprehensive planning process about whether family support means simply self-sufficiency or whether it has a deeper meaning in terms of family strengthening. And Sharon Lynn Kagan, who has been to Oregon several times, is the best spokesperson, I think, for the family support movement. The definition that you see in statute actually is consistent with the federal definition, which I have on another piece of paper, community-based services that promote the well-being of children and families, designed to increase the strength and stability of families, to increase parents' confidence and competence in their parenting abilities, to afford children stable and supportive family environments, and otherwise enhance child development. So that is the federal definition of family support, and through this bill, Oregon would adopt a similar definition. Secondly, we have been working throughout the last several months with people who have been commenting on the bills, and as I've been talking with people, some ideas have sprung forth, so I've actually proposed to Representative Cruz that there may be some amendments forthcoming. One of the amendments that we are drafting deals with the fiscal impact, and we're proposing to put on Section 4, Line 23, within available funding, the State Commission on Children and Families and Local Commission shall, and so forth. So that one you will see when you get to a work session. Secondly, on lines 29 and 30, this is the line that asks the state and local commissions in this process to consult with family support services and then name some types of services, and these were chosen because they tend to use best practices in parenting support. The line funded with state alcohol and drug abuse programs has been questioned twice, once by Mentally Sachs, and it is kind of confusing, I think, because none of the others tell where the funding source is, so we would recommend taking those words out, starting with funded with state alcohol and drug to the end of the line, and then the first two words of line 30, abuse funds. So it would just say family or parent education programs without listing where the funding source comes. I think the original idea was that programs like Pauli Martel's that were created by the legislature in terms of best practices would be included in that group. And then lastly, just to answer a question also in terms of whether dollars would come with this, we recognized in developing these bills that there are cuts being done right now at the legislature. We're certainly not in a position to be adding funding to programs as much as we would probably like to. There are some funds available through local commissions on children and families for parenting. It certainly isn't enough, but it's never enough. However, we will probably have to make do with the funds that we have in this tight climate. However, if you look on lines 37 and 38, one of the tasks of the bill is to identify additional sources of state, federal, and private resources that it could assist family support services in the future. And that would include funds through better coordinating services, funds through federal grants, funds through working with private foundations. And we've just barely scratched the surface in terms of looking at a system on how to pull private foundations into looking at the comprehensive plans as a source of needs assessment, gaps analysis, best practices, and so on. And I think that there's really an opportunity there to do that as well. So that perhaps answers the question about whether it was anticipated that funds would come with this bill. And the answer, at least from my perspective, was no, but that the task in there is to identify resources that are available throughout the system to be able to fund these types of programs.
Janet, it seems to me that in Section 6 that you're suggesting the State Commission on Children and Families make a report and compile a lot of this information. Wouldn't they need more, another FTE or at least someone else, if that's going to increase their workload? Wouldn't that, by definition, require them to do more work?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, if you believe that a state agency's workload is always static and that any time something is put into the workload that they need to add staff, then the answer would be yes. My experience working at the State Commission is that work ebbs and flows. And in fact, when I was a staff person there, I was actually asked to spend my time to write the Family Preservation and Support State Plan that went into the federal government. It took me probably 2 solid weeks of my time to do so, but that was part of my assignment as being a staff person at the State Commission on Children and Families. So my sense would be that if the State Commission and local commissions have work groups that work on it and someone writes up a report, that that report would be part of the tasking of the various people that are part of the system, and that you wouldn't necessarily hire a report writer to be a permanent staff person added on to an agency to do that work. That would be my read on the situation.
Yeah, follow up. And Janet, you know, I haven't had a lot of experience with the state commissions except being on this committee last session, but it seemed to me that the legislature and the state commission was not very prescriptive. It was more to support the county commissions. And this seems very prescriptive, like we're dictating what the county commissions, what their goal will be. And it seems to me that that's somewhat different from at least what we experienced in last session.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, if you read sections of Senate Bill 555, which talks about the tasks that local and state commissions have to go through with comprehensive planning, I would think you'd find the language to be relatively similar. Secondly, also with the Governor's Oregon Children's Plan last time, I think you'd find the language to be relatively similar to this language.
Why would we need this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I'm talking about in the planning function. This would be in the function of looking at parenting as part of the system. There is no language in the current statute that addresses parenting per se. In the past, every bill that the legislature has looked at in parenting has either prescribed parenting through schools, which the school lobby has always opposed, or prescribed a particular curriculum to be used statewide, whether it be media literacy or some other curriculum, rather than looking at the systemic features of parenting. How does it link with the comprehensive plans? What are the best practices for parenting? How do we find money to do it? How do we make sure that the people who are providing the parenting have the skills that they need? What are the principles we're going to use in the state of Oregon to take a look at the parenting issue? And it was a theme in almost, 28 plans that came out of the local commission, so it is a very large issue for them. I don't see this bill as being prescriptive other than clearly identifying
what the goals of this particular task would be in considering how parenting fits into the broader system at both a state and a local level, and making sure that if we, as you heard testified by Minnelli and others, that if we have public funds going into parenting, that they're going into parenting programs that work, that we know research supports, that have qualified professionals leading those groups, and that will be an asset to Oregon's parent and parents, children, and families. So that is my goal. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Committee, one of the real challenges of chairing the committee is trying to predict the future, and I may not have done a very good job in this case. We've got a lot of folks to testify on these various bills. It's my intention to try to get through it, and I realize some of you may have 10:30 appointments, and if you need to go, that's fine. We're scheduled to go on the floor at 11:30, and hopefully we're done by then. But we will see. And I'd also ask the folks testifying, if you have written testimony, please just paraphrase it because we can read it, and try to be as concise as you can. The next bill we're going to be discussing is House Bill 2121, and oh boy. We have first on the list is William and Jennifer, and I'm not even going to try to attempt the last names. But do you want to try those?
Lifely?
Yes. Yeah, that's the Jennifer.
From Lyons.
Yeah.
Lytle.
Yes.
That's what we meant.
Correct. You can come forward.
What we really need is to have a pharmacist on staff, because if they can read doctor's handwriting, they can read anybody's. But
watch.
Well, Chairman Cruz and fellow staff and committee members, my name is Bill Lytle. I live out in Lyons in the Santa Ana Canyon area, and I'm here today strictly as a volunteer, into many of the programs that have been implemented through the Children's and Families Commissions, not only in Marion County, but in Linn County and also Josephine County. I'm not completely aware that Representative Anderson and I go back a ways. I spent an interim period of time as the county commissioner in Josephine County, and I was also involved in that terrific program that is in place there in Grants Pass. One of the things that, and very briefly, I'll just explain to you that as a volunteer in this organizations that are doing children and families work, I look at the operations pretty much as being in a rural community, and I'm now talking about rural communities. I'm talking about the Butte Falls, the Cave Junctions, the Mill Cities, Detroits, and that sort of area. There we're in a little bit of a different situation than some of the larger metropolitan areas and some of the other rural areas. Economically, I know that this has been a problem, and you are all aware of that. But I look at these rural communities, maybe kind of like I'm fortunate enough to have been able to retire here in this great state of Oregon and raise some donkeys and have a few mules and so on and some chickens. And I look at this whole program a lot like the chicken industry. The fellow that has the chickens gets a super amount of hens, and he expects a lot of production to come from those hens. But it isn't until he gets himself a really good rooster that things start to progress. And so when you look at these little communities and you come out there with programs and you try to get volunteers to do that, you really don't have a real big problem, because everyone is interested, I'm sure, in families, children, and for the wellness of their community. But when you get when you get to that point, there has to be some roosters, or this whole thing just dissolves itself over a period of time, whether it's burnout or whether it's the fact that these individuals in these small communities have a business to run, and it's very difficult for them to attend meetings that are necessary. And when I say attend meetings, and you've already heard this morning, and you hear, I'm sure, additional, there are a tremendous amount of organizations and groups and nonprofits that are trying to do and are doing a lot of things for children and families. So now these roosters find themselves in these little rural communities trying to do what they're expected, and they're also trying to go to these various meetings. So I look at House Bill 2121, and I may be completely wrong here, but as I read over the 8 pages that I received off of the computer, I kind of viewed this as being somewhat of a, I've got the Oregon State Commission, I've got the county commissions now, and they appeared in this House bill to have the information that's going to be necessary to pass down to these small rural communities that's going to eliminate all this running around and back and forth and trying to obtain funding for whatever they need in order to implement programs that are going to provide the children and families with the outcomes that will improve their wellness. Now, in the document that I passed out, it's just a brief review of that, and I attached one of the programs that we participated in where we had at least 5 or 6 different agencies that we had to contact in order to get the funding to put together a program on the tobacco prevention. And I'm pleased with all those folks that assisted us. But the main problem is it takes an awful lot of time for a rural community rooster or whoever is designated to go around to these various organizations or to obtain those kind of funding. I realize the position we're in from a state budgeting standpoint, and I feel that this House Bill 2121 streamlines this whole operation, provides the communications that's necessary, and in response and sort of to the Vice Chair's Representative Tony, as far as additional manpower, if we had additional manpower, I think up front with the children and families, they would be in a position to come out with some kind of a direct avenue, and there are some already in place, that would give us the information that we need. Larger communities may not really need that particular approach as much as what the small communities do, but rural communities are really looking forward to working with children and families, and we're doing that to the best of our ability, and we're doing that based on the information at this point that we're receiving from our children and families commissions. And with that, I'll leave the rest to the commission. Any questions?
Any questions?
Could maybe for the benefit of Representative Barker, Mr. Lytle could explain this hen and rooster thing. I mean, he looked perplexed down there. When
Representative Westland, if that becomes a real issue, we'll do a field.
You'll do that. Well, you're always welcome to come to the canyon anytime.
Thank you very much. Cynthia Risen.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk with you this morning. Marion County Commissioner Janet Carlson asked me to give a local perspective of how this bill looks in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties. And I thought I would talk specifically about Marion County and specifically about the Salem-Keizer area, but first provide a little bit of background.
Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
I apologize. This is my first opportunity to speak before.
You're doing really well so far, but we need your name.
My name is Cynthia Risen. I'm director of the Mid-Willamette Education Consortium.
Thank you.
And housed at Chemeketa. So the reason for the work that we've been doing in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties is to make sure that our youth have the opportunity to participate fully and succeed in the quality of life in Oregon and the nation, and that we believe that students need an opportunity to align their educational academic skills with their work-based learning career opportunities. Through an intentional, thoughtful discussion and work, we've hoped to and are making efforts towards integrating academic content and work-based learning to provide a foundation for all students to complete high school and make the successful transition as they move on to work or post-secondary education. Two acts, one state act and one federal act, inform our work around these topics. The Oregon's Educational Act for the 21st Century outlines clear secondary students' outcomes in attaining academic skills and career-related learning standards. In coordination with the Oregon Department of Education, the Mid-Willamette Education Consortium has provided the opportunity for local high schools to retool and redesign their programs so that students have the opportunity to meet those academic standards and the career-related learning standards, that there's an integration between the work that they're doing in the classroom with the work that they're doing outside the classroom. The Workforce Investment Act, as a federal act, the Workforce Investment Act of 1998, presented the Enterprise for Employment and Education and its partners with the opportunity to further define and develop a system creating youth development strategies and a youth opportunity or a youth development system. It also mandated the creation of a youth council, and the youth council that exists in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties is called the Enterprise Youth Council. The youth council is really the catalyst for a dialogue outlining a comprehensive youth development system that includes schools, employers, chambers of commerce, post-secondary education, community leaders, and youth-serving agencies. In some parts of our region, opportunities for youth development are fragmented, and youth don't have the opportunity for leadership potential. The Youth Council is working on creating more opportunities to develop youth development programs and youth leadership programs. As the bill states, student success can be directly linked to their success in school. And the folks in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County believe that the partnership that they have with the Marion County Children and Families Commission helps create that dialogue for developing a youth development system. So in our region, we created a memorandum of understanding that exists between Marion County Children and Families Commission and the Mid-Willamette Education Consortium. There are three purposes for that memorandum of understanding: to provide leadership and support for design and implementation of a youth development system in collaboration with several stakeholders and partners, education, community partners, and youth-serving organizations. The second purpose is to provide technical assistance and staff development opportunities for youth practitioners, those that have an interest and a passion in youth development, in positive youth development. That memorandum of understanding also has a third focus, and which is around planning, which really is the kind of what this bill talks about, planning for appropriate stakeholders to identify year-round comprehensive youth opportunities that support educational success and transition to the next steps as students and youth move from high school. What do they do next? So it's a picture of that is this. This is what we've asked those partners in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties to work on. There are kind of four themes: academic excellence, career preparation, youth development and support, and youth leadership. Specifically in the Salem-Keizer area, this chart, you'll see the partners that are working in the Salem-Keizer area. And another person who's going to testify later today will talk specifically about the work that she's doing at Northwest Human Services and as part of the Salem-Keizer project. But we ask these partners to come together and look at all of the resources that are available in their communities and have a thoughtful planning discussion about how they use their resources to serve all of the youth in their communities. A specific example of that just came out in the Statesman Journal. January 16th, there was an article in the Statesman Journal that specifically listed dropout reduction, a reduction in the dropout rate in Salem-Keizer schools and all of the high schools. Specifically, the work of those partners in having that conversation about what resources are available in their communities, they pooled their resources to identify dropout specialists, and specifically, I wanted to mention at McKay High School, the dropout rate has reduced from 10% during the 99-2000 school year to 8.7% in the 2000-2001 school year, and to 8.05% in the 01-02 school year. We've seen a decrease in the dropout rate, and also across all ethnic and the ethnic categories. It hasn't just been in a certain population.
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
thanks, Mr. Chair. Cynthia, do we know why the dropout rate decreased?
When those partners got together and pooled their resources, they identified about 100,000 during the 00-01 school year and a little bit less than that during the 01-02 school year to specifically target youth that have dropped out and are on the dropout list, and then to go knock on the door. I noticed that in the Statesman Journal of January 18th, 2002, the quote was, instead of making a couple of phone calls each year to dropouts, staff now go knocking on doors. They work with families and students to find a way for students to return, Mark Dobolo said.
Thank you. I think we addressed responses through the chair.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for that opportunity.
Don't worry about it.
I don't have any other comments. Are there any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you for this opportunity.
Okay, we got a whole bunch of folks representing Youth Peer Court. Jennifer, Lauren, Amy, Meredith, Brandon, and Nathan. I hope I got those names right. However you folks want to do it.
Thank you, Chair Cruz and committee members. I'm Jennifer Strutz. I live in Staten. I represent Friends of the Family, a community progress team through the Children and Families Commission here in Marion County. We are in support of House Bill 2121 because of the youth development projects and programs that we have implemented in our rural area and that we have seen go statewide. Many of them reflect and mirror the programs that are set out, mirror across the whole state. The kids that are with me today work with me through the Youth Peer Court, which is a program to empower youth within their community to adjudicate first-time nonviolent offenses. Pardon me, all of a sudden I... nonviolent offenses through having peers, judge peers, in a courtroom session. And we are a diversion program through the Marion County Juvenile Department. This is also statewide. Some counties do not have peer courts, but we have about 51 peer courts throughout the state. What these kids are going to talk to you about is how it's impacted their lives and impacted their community because of lack of resources and dollars. It's extremely important for these young people to be able to speak and have a voice heard in their community and to see the differences that they make. And when they see that, then it gives them and builds within them character to go on and be successful adults so that when they become adults, they won't be a drain on the society. They will be an impact for good. I'd like to turn over my seat to my kids and let them speak, and I'll be back before you. Once again, in support of 2121.
Hi, my name is Amy Cuther, and I'm in support of the Bill 2121, and I've been an active member of the State and Civil Liberty Youth Peer Court. which is also part of the Friends of Family. I started in peer court when I was in seventh grade, and this was the starting year for our peer court in our community. The peer court has grown tremendously, and I have also, with the help of, I have gotten through with the 6 years of my participation. When I started, I was a quiet young girl who just sat in the back listening to what everyone said. I stayed close to all my friends, not willing to branch out and try new things on my own. As I've gotten older, I've started to make my way to the front and start to ask questions and let my voice be heard. I have grown to be able to speak in public in front of large groups. These past years, I've had the opportunity to travel to New Mexico and Washington, D.C. with our court, and have participated in teaching classes at our national conferences. We've taught mentoring classes and mediation classes. With the help of our peer court, I have become a mentor of a young girl. This is also through the Friends of Family. I have come to be able to help my community by my actions. This young girl started out as being a shy girl and didn't talk a lot, and then she has grown to be very active, and she's doing all sorts of different activities in our community now. Also, with the involvement in peer court, I have had many opportunities to be involved with other groups. I became an active member in the Oregon Youth Court Association, and I got to meet all different kinds of people from all over Oregon and have a chance to plan a statewide conferences for other youths. With the help of different groups I have been involved with, they have helped me in my decision of what I want to go to college to study. Peer court has helped me by getting to know the justice system and the different laws. Peer court and mentoring have helped me to see that the kids out there need our help and our attention. I have now decided to go into the background of criminology and psychology. The Friends and Family have been a great asset to my life, many other and other people's lives. I would like to see that their types of programs keep going so that more kids can grow up and have the same opportunities that I have in my teenage years. When I get older, I'd like to be able to send my kids out into the world knowing that they will have the same opportunities I have.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Amy, what is the Friends and Family program you referred to?
It's a program inside of our community, and it's made up of all different kinds of groups and brought together. I think Jennifer's going to talk more about that Friends and Family group.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Hello. I would like to start off by thanking Representative Cruz and the rest of the committee for allowing me to be here today. My name is Brandon Lindsley. I reside in Sial, Oregon, but go to the State and Union High School. And I've prepared an oral presentation, but due to time reasons and because I haven't quite completed memorizing it, I'd like to just be able to read it off to you. Okay. I'd like to start off by telling you about an amazing student I once knew. This student was one of the best in his class, one who could achieve anything and go anywhere in life that he cared to. And at the same time, this young student wanted to belong. He overlooked his many friends and his amazing academic skills. This was simply because that he felt that they were all too inadequate for others to be impressed by. So one day, a day that was only special in the fact that it was so ordinary, he picked up a payphone and made a prank call to impress his friends. Of course, the call was traced immediately, and although it was not anything terribly serious or dreadful, the fact that he did it was a sign that something needed to be done. So, of course, the young student found himself in a world of trouble. And this small offense, had it not been for programs like peer court, would have caused him to suffer a dire punishment. If he had not been in a community that allowed him to have a second chance, then he may have suffered even worse consequences. Had not been in a community that had programs used to empower, instead of criticize the youth, he may not have seen who he truly was. Had he not been able to meet wonderful people such as Jennifer Stretz and the peer court staff, he never would have seen his full potential and made a goal to work towards and on a daily basis accomplish. And now you're probably asking yourselves, who was this young student? That young student was me. Mm-hmm. With the help of programs designed to help and benefit the community and youth of our state, I believe we can better the empowerment, the inspiration, and above all, the quality of our daily lives for everyone. Had it not been for community programs such as peer court and devotion of people we see in our everyday lives, such as Jennifer Stretz, I myself may have never been able to see my full potential. It is the community and the programs we instill in our communities that allow me to be to the full potential who I am today. And some of you might be asking what that goal was I set for myself to accomplish. And actually, the main goal I set was to apply to and enter Phillips Academy of Andover in Andover, Massachusetts. And starting this year, I actually applied, and I'll be getting my response later this month, I believe.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Mr. Chair, yes. I just wanted to know Brandon's age.
15.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman Cruz and representatives, for allowing me to speak here today. My name is Lauren Macy. I'm a 13-year-old, and I am an 8th grader at Staten Middle School. I have been actively involved in Peer Court for about 1 year. Peer Court has given me so many experiences that I cannot replace. Peer Court has given me the chance to see what the judicial system is like. I have spent many fulfilling hours participating in Peer Court. The people I work with are like a second family to me. I have made many friends, some who are much older than me, but very much like me. It is such a wonderful feeling to know that I have changed other children's lives for the better. To know that you could have made a new friend by helping them through a tough time in their life when they made a mistake. No one can ever give me the same kind of feeling that I get back from helping my community stay safe so that kids, young and old, aren't put in situations that can be hazardous to their health and safety. By helping these people, I know that I have made a difference in my community. Even though the change is small, I've still made a change in my town for the better. I hope that Peer Court can continue to help children in my community who have made mistakes, but we need to have resources to continue Peer Court and other valuable community service activities. So please help make a difference by continuing to provide the necessary resources to ensure that worthwhile community services such as Peer Court will continue in the future.
Any questions? Thank you very much. You need to take speech lessons.
That's right.
Yeah, they're excellent.
That's a wonderful presentation.
Chair Cruz and committee members, they are all part of the Peer Court program, which is a youth development process that we use in Friends of the Family. And you asked about Friends of the Family, and I passed out. We are a community progress team through the Children and Families Commission in Marion County. Our goal is to bring up kids in our community, offer them opportunities. Peer Court's but one of them. We have mentoring programs. We have peer-to-peer mentoring programs. We have soft baby carriers that we hand out free to all new parents in our jurisdiction, which is the North Santiam School District area, which serves Staten, Sublimity, Lyons, Mahama, portions of Scio and Almsville. The front pack helps bond that child to the parent from birth. So we are in the child development, youth development process from 0 to 17, 18. They spoke about Peer Court. We're not here on behalf of Peer Court, although that is a passion. We are here on behalf of children and families and what it offers and can continue to offer through your support of House Bill 2121. Do you have any questions of me?
That's answer your question, Representative.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can you give me as an example of what Peer Court, I don't know, like what kind of things they can do, alcohol?
Not all Peer Courts work with drug and alcohol. Ours does. We take referrals for first-time offenders, and they go through a process through our court. They end up with a mentor to help them continue to finish their sanctions. They go through court. They have community service work, drug and alcohol assessment, evaluation, education, and or treatment. And then they might have to write an apology letter. They may have to do an essay on the effects of the drug. They may draw, and if they're good at art, the kids might ask them to draw how alcohol affects their bodies. Those are the kind of things. They're sanctions that help them to make better decisions about their lives.
Is it also help involve the families of the, because I mean I've just returned from a visit to one of the prisons and talking to those people, and some of the, they're following your parents' footsteps.
Yes, sir. Chair so. Cruz and Representative Baker. The kids have many times sanctioned the parents to parenting programs. Right now we have one that it's attending Dr. Leeds' program on the teenage years, and we have three families that will be attending the Love and Logic classes that started the end of last month. So parents are involved. They must be at court. They sign a contract to be in support of the children. So you can see that we implement a number of areas that the Children and Families Commission and this bill is hoping to continue.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for you. So this will have a fiscal impact, right? So we would refer this on to Ways and Means?
Yes.
Thank you.
I think in keeping with our youth theme of the moment, we have some peer mentors, Jamie, Laura, and Robert. One of the side benefits of being on this committee is we get to hear testimony from time to time from outstanding youth members of our community, and something I always look forward to.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laura Psyche. I'm 17 years old. I'm a senior at South Salem High School. I am a leader in our peer mentor program. I'm also ASB vice president this year, and I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 2121 on behalf of the South Salem High School Peer Mentor Program and also Marion County Children and Family Commissions, who we work with quite a bit. In Section 4, Part 3, subsection the little a of the House Bill, it talks about.
It's the little a, Mr. Chair.
That's a good description. I like that.
I got that.
It says the goals of the statewide youth development system are, and then some of the goals are prevention of alcohol, tobacco, and drug usage, which our peer mentor program deals with through the Reach Clubs. It also talks about prevention of teen pregnancy, which our peer mentor program deals with through STARS, which is Students Today Aren't Ready for Sex. In section the D says youth suicide, which the peer mentor program works through prevention. We do grief and loss trainings for all of our mentors. We're on the crisis team with the counselors of South Salem High School. We had, in the 2000 to 2001 school year, we had 9 suicide referrals. We also have training and train students in surrounding middle and high schools on a variety of teen issues. We do depression, date rape, diversity. We actually train some college peer mentors at Western Oregon on diversity, abuse, eating disorders. So we do a variety of things to help in prevention of teens with at-risk behaviors to help. And we also work with freshman students and middle school students in the middle school mentor programs.
Questions? Please.
My name is Robert Cheshire. I'm with the South Salem Peer Mentor Program. Chair and Cruz and board. I'm pretty much here to give testimony on how much the program has helped me and many people I know. There's been about 3 of my friends whose parents have died, and I've been able to help some of them go through that. One of my parents has actually died, so I can relate to those. The peer mentor program helps us to realize how much the students at our school mean to each other, and most parents don't really know this, but students at school are usually around each other more than they are than adults, because they're with them 6 hours, 5 days a week. And other peers help, I guess you can say, raise them. And so the peer mentor program kind of helps us, teaches us how to help other kids and any problem that they have, and to be good examples. We have classes. Like, in our pre-mentor program, we go to classes, like freshman classes, to make them feel better at school. One of the things that I've done is there's a kid in one of my freshman classes last year, and he was failing about 2 of his classes, and I've made an agreement with him that if he comes once a week after school and I'd help him with 2 of his classes that he needed help with, that if he can get at least a C, then I would take him out to dinner, and he actually came after school, and I was able to help him. And that's just one of many examples that the Peer-Mentor program has been able to help other people. Like she said, there's lots of suicides attempts, and they actually do reach out. We've been trained to recognize that kind of stuff. And I guess, as you can say, for bang for your buck, I guess you can say we would put every penny that we use every penny that we possibly can, and to cut this program would probably be a really big regret. Any questions?
Any questions? Thank you. Please.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. My name is Jamie Wilson, and I'm a peer mentor at South Salem High School. In wrapping this up, I hope that you enjoyed what you're hearing about our program, and I'd like to let you know, as I'm sure you know already, that this is just one program that, and many others are active in the community right now. Running programs such as these cost thousands of dollars each year, with only about $500 coming from the district, which I realize with budget cuts right now, we're not exactly asking for more funding. We're just asking for the realization that we are here and that we would like your support still. We are in cooperation with mainly the Marion County Family Children's Commission, who provides the majority of our funding right now. We also are working with other organizations such as the YMCA, the Boys and Girls Club, Family Building Blocks, who spoke earlier today, Mother Oaks Grief and Loss Center, and the Teen Activities Network, as well as many others. Programs such as these are essential for youth development and preventing at-risk teen behaviors. And so by supporting youth and youth programs with House Bill 2121, you're investing in your future as well as ours. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't resist. These students attend South Salem High School, which is in my district and just a few blocks away from my home. Thank you so much for the fine work that you guys do, Laura, Robert, and Jamie. I really am grateful. Our community is grateful. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yeah, like I said, sometimes we get to hear from some outstanding folks who hopefully at some point in time will be sitting where we are. But not real soon. I mean, like, not next week, so, you know.
today.
Andrew McKay and Gene Lester.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and council members. My name is Jean Lassiter, and I am a resident of Salem, and I am also here representing a conglomeration of efforts that I'm involved in. I'm a member of the Oregon Positive Youth Development Policy and Advisory Council. I'm also a member of the Oregon Runaway and Homeless Youth Coalition. I sit on the Department of Human Services Child Welfare Committee. I'm a board member on the Coalition for Equal Access to Girls. I've been actively engaged locally with the Marion County Children and Families Commission in helping them configure their comprehensive plans for Senate Bill 555. I'm an adjunct professor for Portland State University, and I am probably first and foremost a children and youth provider. I'm coming before you today to make some observations about House Bill 2121, and to consolidate those observations in three primary categories. First is the concept of positive youth development. Second is the leveraging of resources. And third is the support of a systems approach to the care for children. Positive youth development, you have in front of you a packet, or several packets, a pile, I guess is more likely, of information, some definitions about youth development, some developmental youth outcomes. You have my partner Andrew's speech that he's going to talk to you about in a moment. You also have a diagram of the ECHO Youth Opportunity System, which is a system of care that is supported by the Workforce Investment Act here in Salem-Keizer. And accompanying that, you have some information about the Workforce Investment Act system. Do you have any questions about what you have? Okay. Well, there's also some information about assets.
We don't quite have it yet, so at this point, absolutely no questions.
Okay, great. Anyway, it's way too much information for you to digest. I understand that. The first issue that I'd like to address very briefly is the fact that this bill, in spirit, mirrors what's happening on a federal level through the Younger Americans Act, which within it contains five promises to children and youth with regard to core resources. The promises held in the Younger Americans Act are ongoing relationships with caring adults, safe places with structured activities, physical and mental health, marketable skills and competencies, and opportunities for community services and civic participation. On the state level, the bill speaks to much of the work that has taken place and is taking place through the Positive Youth Development Council. This work has been supported through federal funds coming to the state of Oregon through the Family and Youth Services Bureau. The grant was awarded to the state Children and Families Commission 5 years ago, and it has been instrumental in supporting positive youth development works across the state. It is a positive youth development is not a program. It's a philosophy, and it's an approach born of the idea that all children and young people need the opportunity to be partners in their own future and in ours. The vision of the positive youth development movement here in Oregon is that adults in Oregon will view all youth as positive, competent, and contributing individuals in their communities. The mission is to promote policies, quality services, opportunities, and supports that will result in positive outcomes for all youth through state and local partnerships. We have that in place. We are doing it. I have some of the outcomes that have happened over the past 4.5 years by virtue of this opportunity to promote positive youth development. 22 counties have identified youth development activities or strategies as priorities in their comprehensive plans to address specific outcomes. State and local partners developed proposed youth development policies to encourage youth development approach within youth service systems. During 2001 to 2003, approximately 1,400 youth and adults received youth development training to facilitate youth participation and involvement in decision-making processes and other community activities. Over 134 youth development community ambassadors were trained. Some of them are among the South Salem peer mentors that have spoken to you. And 50% of those trained made presentations to local decision makers, schools, and organizations. One of the purposes of, as I understand it, the Children and Families Commission's, as evidenced by Senate Bill 555, is to create comprehensive planning processes across the state and to integrate resources and to leverage those resources. Earlier today, you heard testimony from Cynthia Risen, the executive director of the Mid-Willamette Education Consortium. She mentioned work that had been done in the Salem-Keizer area. That work is represented by the ECHO system, of which you have a diagram. That system is actually a best practices model for service delivery for young people. Those young people are 430 disadvantaged and disenfranchised and very distressed young persons that are at risk of dropping out, that are undereducated and underemployed, that live in this community. The cost of that project that is funded through WIA and the Department of Labor is around about $500,000. It involves 12 partners and it serves 430 kids. In that system are the dropout recovery specialists that were mentioned to you earlier. There's five of them. They work half-time, they're employed by the school district as a partner of the ECHO system, and they go door to door and they knock on the doors of young people who are dropped out or at risk of dropping out. As you can see as in that diagram that's in front of you, there are 12 partners. They are part of a system, and with those partners bring a huge amount of resources. Many of those partners, and I didn't get a chance to count, but many of the partners that are all involved in the ecosystem are also supported through Children and Families Commissions. So really what you have in front of you is a leveraging diagram wherein resources have been united in one project to serve kids coming from multiple systems. These are young people coming from juvenile justice systems. They're coming from state mental health care. They're coming from foster homes. They're coming from the streets. They're coming from schools. They're served by a system of 12 partners. And I think that I'll cut to the chase, because I know that we have a little bit of time and a lot of people with a lot to say to you. What I will say is that I think that the spirit of this bill, I can't speak to the cost of the bill. I don't know anything about that. But what I can say is that the spirit of this bill is to give hope to communities, to provide a mechanism for leveraging resources that are vastly important in the face of the budgetary blight that we face. This is one way that this state can act to support communities and children in a very cost-effective fashion. When these shortfalls come into place, as you all well know, these communities are going to be flooded with individuals, families, and children who have no resources. Children are being cut loose from systems of care all across the state. And if we do not support at some level an infrastructure to take care of those children and those families, we have not only lost one battle, we have lost two. I would encourage you, please, to look at this in as creative and as broad-minded a fashion as you can, because I think that the commissions in this state provide a beacon of best practices, and that they provide us a very hopeful look at the future, and we're going to need that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, I have to leave. I'd love to hear Andrew's speech, and I hope that'll be part of the record. I certainly encourage what you're doing. I just feel like we're facing a storm, a flood of negative things from MTV and TV itself. We need to reach to you, but we also need to reach much deeper.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Cruz and committee members, my name is Andrew McKay, and I am a resident of 1010 East 7th for Dallas, Oregon. I have been a member of the Oregon Positive Youth Development Policy and Advisory Council for over a year, and I am one of many trained as community ambassadors to inform others on positive youth development's merits. Since my exposure to positive youth development, I have reaped a wealth of opportunities, ideas, and motivation otherwise beyond my sight. Positive youth development is not a program pumping resources into a constantly deflating situation, but a framework priming the pump for untapped energy. I was introduced to positive youth development through my local Wasco County Commission on Children and Families. As a member of that group and its subcommittee, the Wasco County Youth Action Council, I was given the opportunity to be trained as a community ambassador and co-present the positive youth development framework to local service and decision-making organizations. Since becoming a part of the Positive Youth Development Policy and Advisory Council, I have helped represent Oregon at the National Youth Summit, co-presented at the 2002 Oregon School Boards Association Conference, and influenced policy at the state and local level. I justify the time and effort dedicated to this cause as worthy of my limited resources because I can see the potential of this novel concept. This is not an elementary task. As a high school student, it is hard to see beyond the meetings, the buzzwords, and the adults to any organized government-based efforts intrinsic value. Ironically, I find it can be just as hard for adults to see beyond youth's apathetic, cynical stereotype to the potential they present to their community. I'm convinced both groups are more alike than they let on. Both contain their share of social barriers preventing the other from understanding the critical perspectives involved. If this is true, then is it no surprise there is so much frustration amongst youth and indignation amongst adults? Between parents, school, and law, there is little a youth can control. Why should one care about what one has no control over? This apathy for the system, carefully tailored by the adult world, and occasional outright rebellion results in justifiable indignation amongst adults concerned about the welfare of youth. Positive youth development seeks to rectify the situation by lending youth the means to influence their environment constructively and feel a part of their community rather than an estranged spectator. Trust is the key here. One must decide whether the people inevitably leading in the future can be trusted to help lead now. I believe one of the major reasons the stereotype of youth is so negative is because we are given little encouragement to break through the smokescreen. Legislatures can pass laws and set up programs to fix the problems of youth for all eternity, but if the youth themselves are not active participants, it will be but a trickle of fish to feed the starving. I'm here to say youth need fishing poles, not fish. Give us the means to remedy the problems we see from the inside, and together we will reap the wealth of collaboration. Thank you for your time and attention. Are there any questions?
Well stated. Some of us dinosaurs do remember rebellion, trust me.
Don't look at me when you say that.
You don't remember rebellion, Representative? Thank you very much. Well, very good testimony. We are going to move on to House Bill 2120, and first up, Gary Smith and Gina Furman. You don't mind tag teaming? I think you know each other, so. Good morning,
Chairman, Representative Cruz, and members of the committee. My name is Gary Smith. I'm the mental health director for Deschutes County. I'm going to rip through this. I'm sure you'll be pleased about that. Morning, Representative Westland as well. I'm here essentially to not support 2120 as it's written, but I think with some tinkering it could be made to work because I think its intentions are correct and it's headed in the right direction. I'd like to preface my remarks quickly by saying that I'm assuming that planning of some sort is still going to be a reality in Oregon, even though there isn't any money left to plan for. And I have to admit, in Deschutes County, our hearts really aren't in planning right now because we were one of the worst funded counties to start with, and after this is done, we'll be even worse off. But nonetheless, planning is critical, I believe, because you as decision makers need to know what the needs are and to make decisions accordingly. And as Representative Chair Cruz knows from being on the Mental Health Alignment Work Group that we served for a year, I think, seemed like a long year, one of the recommendations then was to do comprehensive planning, and House Bill 3024 was the product of that. And we also considered other options, including block grant dollars to counties. Back then, Chair Cruz, I think it was 3 years ago when we started that process. It had been 10 years before that, prior, there was no mental health plan for Oregon that was updated. So I understand that 2120 is talking about a broader field of fire than mental health, obviously. So I'm going to limit my remarks to how I think 2120 could be fixed. Hopefully, you could acknowledge in the bill the statutorily defined groups that are already in existence, such as local alcohol and drug planning committees, mental health advisory boards, and so forth. In Deschutes County, our commission has done a really good job of acknowledging the expertise of those volunteers that serve in those committees and building their involvement into the comprehensive plan at the local level. So I'd like to see that in the bill. I'd like a stronger identification of consumers and family members as active players in the development of the local plan. I think calling for a single local plan is excellent. Unfortunately, I don't see strong enough language calling for a single state plan. And unless the state essentially gets its act together, we can't coordinate at the local level, no matter how much we want to. And I think in Deschutes, we've taken the process as far as we can without the state joining us in that effort to have a single plan. Right now, my department has to prepare at least six separate plans. They all have different due dates, different timelines, different guidelines, different rules and regulations, and only a passing mention, in my opinion, of each that the state acknowledges that these plans exist. So they say you should coordinate with this one or that one, but there's really no beef to that. And I'm real concerned, and I'd like 2122 to address that. The CCF at the state level and at the local level has been designated as the local planning or as the planning entity for these comprehensive plans. I don't particularly have a problem with the CCF doing that. In fact, if the state model could look like Deschutes County, it'd be great. However, the CCFs have a glaring weakness, I think, in most places, I'm told, and that is that they don't deal with or are not recognized as experts in folks over 18, people with severe and persistent mental illness, for example, chronic alcoholism, developmental disabilities, and that kind of stuff. So they really have to rely on the local expertise or advisory boards and staff, I think, to pull that together from the various departments. I go on to talk about a specific date. I've been in this business 30 years now. I think this is my, how many years, how many sessions is that, 15? Anyway, a lot of legislative sessions. We've been talking about something, I think, as long as I've been in the business, and that is why do we do planning if that planning never gets into the governor's budget, never gets into your radar? These due dates have, to my mind, no significance at all to the development of the biennial budget, and they should. Or at least you should have a chance to say, great, we'll work on that 2 years from now, can't fund it right now, but at least we know what the needs are. So the timing is critical. And finally, what I would say is that the local boards of county commissioners are key components of this whole process. They're the alcohol and drug, mental health, public health officials, and I believe that they should have a prime opportunity to review and approve any plans that come through from the counties to the state. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Westland.
I guess statement and two questions. Gary, I mean, I agree with you on the planning dollars, and I think it was the 71st Legislative Assembly's full intention to plan the mental health, fund the Mental Health Advisory Board. As you know, we hit several significant speed bumps along the way, known as revenue shortfalls.
That was more like brick walls, but anyway.
No, those are just speed bumps. The brick wall we're going to hit comes in March. I mean, and that's the point. We still got two revenue forecasts left, and this isn't over yet. And so,
and they're still going down.
The so, like I say, I just want to talk to the. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, why plan if you're not going to do it? And I think it was. I know it was the 71st Legislative Assembly's intention that go forward. Regrettably, we're in the financial catastrophe we're in. But my question is this is a serious question. Did you have to ride over with Scott Johnson this morning?
Chairman Cruz, representing Westland. I didn't have that opportunity, unfortunately.
Oh, that's why you look so fresh. And
I would have liked it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Gary, we'd welcome any suggestions you have as far as amendments or coordinate with Janet. So, I mean, clearly this is the whole area of mental health is going to take a much bigger stage, probably, and Representative Westland's committee, as it will turn out when we start exploring the structure of that. And you're right, it's tough to just plan.
Go ahead. And we're going to need your help as well of all the mental health providers' input. I mean, it's going to be a big deal. I will echo the governor's words. I mean, we are not going to continue to do business as usual. And so there is going to be significant change. Jeff and I are going to be sitting side by side. Jeff sits on my committee. I sit on his. And we're going to be helping to lead that charge. So.
Well, Chairman Cruz, if I could just add, I referenced the white paper, which obviously you can read at your leisure, or staff could do that. That's attached to my testimony. That's co-authored by Scott Johnson and myself. Contains basically the key elements of what we would change in 2120, I believe.
Okay.
And then also the Mental Health Alignment Work Group, again, that we put so much time into. I hope that you all look at that as you look at changing mental health in Oregon, because we put a lot of thought into that, as you well know. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Just
one comment. It's counties may come up with a decision that they just can't deal with mental health because there is no funding, and that's what's so scary about it. So I am right behind Jeff and Ben when they say, the representatives, when they say that we can't do business as we did before, but hopefully it'll be some kind of business. Let's see what that is.
Chairman Cruz, Representative Anderson, I agree with you entirely. It's way too important to, and I know that I can see it on your face as you understand how important mental health is. Thank you.
Gina.
Chair Cruz, committee members, for the record, my name is Gina Furman. I'm the executive director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. The Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs has not taken an official position on House Bill 2120 and is still discussing the possible ramifications of the bill. While we are very supportive of the concept of coordinated comprehensive planning, our experience has been through House Bill 3024 passed in the 2001 session that we are already required to do comprehensive planning, and in reality, it has created another required plan and another step. Mental health directors are now required to do a separate alcohol and drug prevention plan, biennial alcohol and drug implementation plan, Senate Bill 914 plan, House Bill 3024 plan, a gambling treatment plan, and then be part of a separate comprehensive Senate Bill 555 community comprehensive planning process. We have no guarantee that House Bill 2120 will lead to a more streamlined comprehensive planning process. We are concerned that, especially in this time of grave program cuts to direct client services and total elimination of crisis services, that we will not have adequate staff to carry out these comprehensive planning layers. And I received a telephone call Friday night. Linda Fleming from CLO, the Conference of Local Health Officials, is very ill and was not able to make it today, and she wishes me to concur, the Conference of Local Health Officials, and I believe you have a letter in front of you stating the same concerns. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Well, you know, as the sponsor of 3024, yeah, you know, I think what it points out to is that we do a lot of things with the best intentions in the world that just totally hamstring the local folks. This, when you look at this particular bill, it says relating to local coordinated comprehensive plans, creating new provisions. It's a vehicle we could do some things, I think. So we're open input. I think there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 mandated planning processes that the state has put in place, and clearly this time we did some significant house cleaning there.
Representative Cruz, the mental health directors of your local counties and communities look forward to working with you to streamline the process.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Yeah, Jennifer?
Chair Cruz and committee members, I'm Jennifer Strutz. I am speaking on behalf of Stacey Graham. You're receiving a statement from her. Stacey is a board member of Friends of the Family. We sit together as on the board of Community Progress Team here in Marion County. She's a community volunteer. She is in support of House Bill 2120, also 2123 and 2124. This is affecting planning for children, families, and communities. You have it in front of you. If you'd like me to read it, I'll read it. She underlined statements that she felt were extremely important. Stacey's very articulate. She's also extremely passionate about children and families. She helped write the comprehensive plan for Senate Bill 555. So her comments are intelligent and educated and informed, much more so than mine are on this, and so I will leave it to you to read.
Okay, and we will. Thank you. This very skinny little bill with very little bold black could become a rather significant piece of legislation by the time it's done. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Janet.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee that are still here, thank you so much for staying. I just wanted to make several comments on House Bill 2120 and then talk about its relationship to the other two bills that are about planning. First of all, I am a brand new member of the Association of Oregon Counties, having been elected a Marion County Commissioner. And one of the proposals that has come forward from AOC this session is to look at services from a systems approach, that we can no longer be looking at public health and mental health and public safety and state delivered human services as separate entities, but we have to realize that counties are the delivery systems for state services in many cases. And I think that this philosophy is what undergirds the concept that brought House Bill 2120 forward. Representative Westland, I believe, served on the audits committee during the, is that correct, sir, during the interim, and the Legislative Fiscal Office did do an audit of the planning process for commissions on children and families. One of their proposals was that House Bill 3024 be merged into the Senate Bill 555 planning process. We discussed this in the small group that brainstormed these bills, and also believed that we didn't want to exclude public health from the opportunity to do coordinated planning, and so brought them in as well. This has become somewhat of a controversial bill. I recognize that you've probably been hearing from some of your constituents on it. I know I've been hearing from numbers of people on it. I've been trying to work through the different issues that people are bringing forward. There is a relationship to the other bills. First of all, what this bill does is it adds public health and public safety into the comprehensive plans. We are proposing some amendments to it that, again, I sent to Sandy. On page 2, line 33, the word comprehensive would be taken out, and it would just say local plans developed for the delivery of mental health services, and it would say for children 0 to 19 and their families. It would take out adults. So that would deal with the issue that person who just spoke from Deschutes County discussed about the adult sector and whether that really fits within the comprehensive plan. The other part that would be taken out would be lines 37 and 38. We would end it at suicide prevention, which is about three quarters of the way through that line. So we take out access and outreach and then the whole rest of the next line. So that's our proposal with this bill, is to limit it. And again, I have spoken before Chloe, and Gina Furman has been working with mental health directors and have invited them to come forward with language that meets their needs so that the parameters are set in a way that makes sense to them. House Bill 2123 adds public health, mental health, and other local partners to the state team, which is currently operating informally. It was developed under Governor Kitzhaber to work on this state plan that was just talked about as well as being needed. They are actually working on a single allocation format for counties to send in plans and budgets for juvenile, for early childhood, for alcohol and drug, for local commissions, because those are named in the comprehensive plans. The plans that are not named are not part of that process. So I think it behooves us to consider, as we're naming or not naming plans, whether we want those plans to be part of that more integrated process. They're looking at data systems, they're looking at how outcomes get collected, they're looking at a number of different issues, and I'll allow them to speak to that because I'm not an expert and haven't gone to their meetings, but this is an informal process. What 2123 does is makes it formal. It puts it in statute. It asks that more than half of the members be from the local level, so that as we're developing criteria for reviewing and approving the plans, that local people have a voice in setting those criteria. So the workload issue would be encompassed within that process to determine how much or how little work would be involved in integrating the plans in. I know in the counties I've worked in, the plans are pretty much already integrated in because we worked at having all of those folks at our tables. In other counties, that may not be the case. The House Bill 2124 puts the governor's executive order, Governor Kitzhaber's executive order, into statute. That was also brought before the Audits Committee as part of the recommendations from the Legislative Fiscal Office. And I believe that there are people in the State Commission that are going to speak to that bill. But again, it also asks state agencies to take a look at the contents of the comprehensive plans and use it in developing their budgets. And again, if plans are named as part of that comprehensive plan, then they're part of that executive order. But it actually
splits people into sort of the primary stakeholders and then the secondary stakeholders or the affiliates. And so those that are named are a core part of it. Those that are not named are sort of voluntary. So they're not considered when times and places for meetings are pulled together and that type of thing. So it's really important, I think, for public health and mental health to be part of the whole if we are going to consider them to be part of the system, which they are a key component of the system. And I just wanted, I gave you a handout, and when I worked on my dissertation in 1997, and this was a survey that I sent out to four counties as part of my dissertation study, and the reason that I chose those counties was because there were a number of wonderful things going on for children and families. My dissertation was on improving outcomes for children and families, and looking particularly at family resource centers and integrated services in doing that. So these counties were sort of on the cutting edge in terms of their partnerships, in terms of the work that was being done there to integrate services. And I asked various groups, I sent it to various people, and then I grouped them by county, and then I also grouped them again by the type of stakeholder that they were. So I put elected officials together. Those would include county commissioners, state legislators. I think I had one couple city councilors in there. Local commission and state commission folks, county agencies, which would be juvenile, mental, and public health, state agencies, which at the time was AFS and SCF, school people and ESDs, and then the coordinators from the family resource centers themselves. And I asked them a number of different questions, what they thought about benchmarks, how important they thought different roles were for state and local agencies, whether they thought things had been accomplished. This is just some data from that, and again, it's about 5 years to almost 6 years old now. And I think a number of counties have worked through these issues, but one of the things I didn't expect to see that I did, if you'll notice, was that there's one particular element here that's bumped way down on the bar chart, if you look across those bar charts. When you ask how important are the following roles for local commissions on children and families, and a four would be very important, and a one would be not at all important. And if you look at recommending changes in state and local policies, facilitating coordination and local collaboration, creating comprehensive plans, monitoring and evaluating programs, and linking best practices research with programs, I think there's a significant difference between the one group with the remaining groups. Mm-hmm. Also, if you look at to what extent has your local commission influenced increases, so what have they done in accountability, in local data, in... And the last one would be county and state, actually in county and state policies, increases in positive changes in those policies. Again, there's quite a significant difference. And I was surprised to see this, and I think that it sort of is telling about the whole issue that we're dealing with here, that we need to have a process, and I don't know whether it's here or whether it's at AOC or whether it's elsewhere, where we start working through kind of the history and where the money went 10 years ago and where we are now and who's on first and all of the other issues that go into human services, because as I said at the beginning, if we don't work together now, we're not going to have a system, as Representative Monis Anderson so aptly stated earlier. We need to make sure that we can hang on to the services that we have and deliver them in the very best way that we can through these tight times. So I just want to emphasize that I recognize that there are certainly disagreements about how this gets done, and maybe this is a bill that's 2 years ahead of its time. Maybe we can all work together in the interim and come back with something next session. But I do think that it's an issue that needs to be addressed, both at the local and state level, in trying to pull us together so that we really are a system and acknowledge each other as partners. So that is my 2 cents worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was really wonderful to hear all of the people that testified today, because these services are so critical in making sure that our kids are ready to learn. I mean, there's just no question. I wish I had known about these bills a little earlier, because I also have one that's very similar to this, but it includes child care, and having child care be a part of the comprehensive plan also. Actually working with the employment division, and there's block grant money. So I think that we have to look outside of the box as to where we can tap into some funds, and there are federal funds for planning, and it should maybe be an option. You know, I don't know, this may come across as a mandate, but it would be nice to, like you say, get the framework there, and then if we're able to tap into, say, funds like from the federal level, that could be a part of this planning. Back in 93, or whenever Senate 555 was implemented, I was a part of that very painful process of bringing nonprofits and the private sector and the public sector together. But the outcome is so wonderful in getting these agencies to work together. But they do need resources. So, Ben, get the resources. Jeff, get the resources.
Thank you.
Question?
Yes, Representative Pomeroy.
Thank you. Janet, what is the approval process for the public and mental health plans that are being added to the list of planning elements in the local commission's coordinated comprehensive plan?
Well, Representative Cruz, Representative Tomei, the way that the plans were approved during this last cycle, it was a very interesting process because there was, as I said, a state team that developed some criteria. They put that criteria out actually during the last legislative session. People went and testified and said, this won't work for us, particularly the larger counties, Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington, Marion. They were designed in a way that was so detailed, I think it would have been very difficult for large counties to accomplish that. They were scaled back down, revised guidelines were sent out in the late spring. Counties then started working on their plans over the summer. They were due January, at the end of January, and then they were sent back to reviewers who were part of that state team, who then determined whether the plans met the criteria that was in this rather lengthy document that came out. And then kind of that process worked through, and you'll hear some testimony about that from some other folks that lived through that. And so really, I guess my point being that the approval processes depend on what the review teams say they are. And so since the review team has never been in statute, and since it was a developmental process, and I'm not here to necessarily be negative about kind of what's happened in the past, because this didn't come with an instruction manual, and nobody, you know, we were sort of feeling our way through it both at the local level and at the state level. It was really tough for them to kind of know how to put out criteria and for us to know how to respond to something that was sort of so open-ended. In terms of the mental health and public health plans as they exist now, my sense about how it would work is much like the juvenile crime plans worked, because they're actually named in statute right now, and that is that we took, in the counties I worked with, the broad goals that were in those plans, incorporated them along with the other broad goals from everybody else in our large plan, and then by reference just said this plan is part of the broader plan, because the comprehensive plans are really an umbrella, and they aren't even in the implementation stages yet. They really just set out the broad goals, the priorities, and what some of the strategies would be. And so you could just by reference bring in the plan, and again, depending on how much work the partners have done together, it could be a lot of work or it could be a little work, depending on what the review team asks to be submitted at the state level.
Thanks, Janet. Could I ask any other questions, Mr. Chair?
Very quickly, we've still got five bills to get through.
Okay. Many of these health plans already require approval by the state or federal agencies. So does the local commission have the ability to refocus the plans as they see appropriate?
Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, as I mentioned in statute, the role of the local commission is a convener and a facilitator. It is not an approver, and it's not a policy setter. And I think part of the rub that you've seen in terms of the history is that mental health and public health are run by people who have a great deal of expertise. They are professionals in their fields to the greatest extent. And local commissions are, by definition, 51% lay members. And sometimes that kind of hits some differences in terms of perception there as well. So I think, you know, what the commission can do is buy the public into the idea of how these services fit in the broader public sector through the community mobilization that we talked about. That doesn't negate the necessity of the expertise of people in public health and mental health to be able to put that into their plan and be able then to explain to their partners why these things are necessary. So, no, the commissions are not in the role of redirecting. Certainly, if there were some inconsistencies in direction or broad goals and priorities with other major partners, it would behoove the partners to try to work that out.
All right. Thank you, Janet. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
As we move on through our matrix, 21, 23, we have my mentor, Jillian.
Mr. Chair?
She may not want to be identified as that, but...
We don't have all day.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, what's the plan for the rest of the hearing? Or are we going to go through
Sandy's checking on that right now. Representative Mona Sanderson just said that all the bills on today's schedule have been postponed, and we're supposed to have a joint session with the Senate. If that's the case, we may not have any choice but to adjourn and go to it. But Sandy's checking that out right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So in the meantime, Jillian, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Chairman Cruz and members of the committee, I'll try and be as brief and succinct as I can. My name is Jillian Nicolaitis. I'm the director of the Douglas County Commission on Children and Families. And on a personal note, I just want to throw in there, I was a latchkey kid, the product of divorce. I personally got divorced because my ex-husband got involved in cocaine. I raised two kids. I went back and got my bachelor's and helped to raise a grandchild in my house till she was 5 and a half. And now I'm engaged to a man who has a four-year-old. So I don't know. You know, there's something about kids that from my experiences and just watching everything I've been through, which not necessarily of choice, I'm very, very grounded in what the commissions are doing and family support, because I've seen in many points in time in my life when I went back to school with two little girls by myself how important family support is. So I just wanted to add that note from my own personal experience. What I'd like to talk today about is the positive process of planning we had, the positive results of planning that we had, and the challenges of planning that we had, and why I'm here to support this bill. What I'd like to say on a positive note was that we had some very, very good partnerships. We brought people to the table that have never been to the table before. For example, churches, other nonprofits. We seemed to get county entities, but we added state entities. And what happened through these planning processes is we became a team. We became people who could actually look at the planning process and what was needed in Douglas County without people saying, you know, I want this, my agency wants this. We actually came together and said, okay, you know, I could actually do this piece and you're doing this. And we actually saw gaps and we saw crossovers of what people were doing, and during the planning process came up with some really, really useful information that helped us along the way. Also, we had other people, we had systems. The commissions, when we look at planning, I appreciated all the people who were here today to talk about their agencies, but I'd like to stress that we look at systems. We look at, you know, children. So if they have Healthy Start, that's great, but that's a certain risk level. So then you go on to relief nurseries because you have higher risk. And then at each point in time, there's an area that children need something. And so I wanted to make sure that we're looked upon as a system and not just agencies, because they do wonderful jobs. But if, you know, the more we do planning and the more we realize where the gaps are and fill in, the better off we are. Okay, as far as the results in Douglas County, what we have found is that we have many, many funding streams as a commission, but we also have many funding streams as a community. And what we do is we look at what's needed. For example, the commission in Douglas County serves as a conduit for any grants that come down from any area. For example, we are the juvenile crime prevention main piece. We oversee the grant for prevention. And what you have in front of you right now, and I just want to give you an example as we keep talking about best practices, is a letter from Jeff Sprague and Hill Walker of the University of Oregon. And I think they've also sent these out on their own saying, for Douglas County, it's a good example of juvenile crime prevention. We chose multisystemic therapy. We asked the University of South Carolina if we could go younger, fourth through sixth graders. And we looked at our system and we said, this is a missing piece. And we found that multisystemic therapy, which is counseling 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, 3 to 6 months for those families who end up in the juvenile system time and time again. Those are the families who dropped out of school, the parents did, who won't go near a school. These are the families that, you know, law enforcement keeps saying, you know, they'll tell you the names. You'll talk to judges in your communities and they'll tell you the names of families generationally that go on and on and on. I think you find that. And what multisystemic therapy, which is one of the 11 blueprint programs at the University of Colorado, has been proven to reduce juvenile delinquency behavior. And we were hoping, as a system, we looked at our juvenile crime prevention dollars and we said, you know, they're possibly not enough as they're cut. Who's willing to pitch in more? Who's willing to give up something? Who's willing to be devoted to this to carry it through? Because it's very frustrating when you, as a system, get something and you have to give it up because the money's no longer there. So sometimes when you're doing the planning, another piece of that is who's committed? who's committed to following through on whatever it takes to keep these things going. And that, to me, is a real exciting piece versus looking at silos. It's no longer silos. It's looking at what's the good of the whole for the spectrum of families, because we all see them over and over again. Another example in planning was the courts were sending children to, parents to parenting classes, and what they found was there were no parenting classes. So the families were told, okay, as part of the court order, you have to go to parenting classes. But then the judges went, well, gee, there is nothing. And so then we as a system have to look at that and say, okay, if there is nothing, then what do we as a system do to make something? And we have done that. We've gone after grants. We have an early childhood group that I'm presently chair of. We've gone after grants from the Ford Family Foundation, from Cal Creek Foundation, and we provide parenting classes that weren't there before, and we look at what the needs are, and we can't do everything, but we pull the schools together, we pull everyone together and say what exists, what needs to be done, where are we going? And that, to me, is the critical piece of planning. It's not so much as filling in the blanks as it is looking at your community. And I think that's why local control is so important, because only you know what's going on in your community, other people don't. So it's nice to have the framework of planning, but it's also critical to have the partnerships. In Douglas County, we didn't have Healthy Start, we didn't have relief nurseries, but what we did was we said, okay, we're committed enough that we're going to put money in, and this is collective money in a system, we're going to do our own Healthy Start, we're going to do our own relief nurseries. From that led, when we got state money, we could expand it. But we were committed enough to do that before we were able to get money, because the money was not the issue. It was being committed to what was needed, looking at the systemic piece of it. So I just wanted to show those pieces. Also, I'd like to talk a little bit about the challenges and why I support this bill. The challenges are that we had a great state team that put together the criteria, but if you look at the process, which we had to live through, you got the planning guide in January, and what happened was it kept changing. So we didn't know what our planning guide really was until July. So we pulled all these partners together, and we had to keep saying, well, now it's this. Oh, no, now it's this. And I know that sometimes in the evolution of planning, the state partners had to keep running to keep up with, they were just inventing as they were going too. But when it comes down to the local level, it's very frustrating when your criteria keeps changing and you're trying to pull together credibility of your partners and you want them to take the plan as a credible piece for your community. And so what I would like, and what I like about the plan, is it calls for local members to be on the state team. For example, juvenile directors, mental health directors, people who know the system. So it's my feeling that if they had been on the state team to begin with, maybe we wouldn't have some of the glitches that we had. For example, 26 county plans were not approved in the first round. And I think part of that is because the planning was not clear. It was not clear what the expectations were. Part of this bill talks also about being sure to share with the counties a year in advance what those expectations are, so that we're all at different stages. Some of us are farther advanced in planning than the state team is, so if we know a year in advance, then we can do our work and we can do quality work versus always running to keep up with the criteria. Another piece in this bill is it says that if we have amendments, that we'll keep it on the county level, that it will be approved by the county commissioners, and I think that's important because, as you see here today, when needs come up, to have to take every amendment that we do and take it to the state would not be, it just would not be appropriate, would not be helpful to communities. When you have things that say, is it in your plan, and you say, oh, gee, no, it isn't, we hadn't thought from that perspective, there needs to be a piece where the county can amend their plan and move forward, and sometimes that happens quickly. So those are the main pieces of what I wanted to bring forward, and I think if you include the local people in the plan, I think that they will buy into it, and those, as you look at each community, there are differences, and so I just wanted to bring that forward. And I just want to show you, this is Douglas County's plan, and when we had to redo our plan, we wanted to make sure we put everything in there so we passed, and sometimes that takes up a lot of extra work that I don't think you should have to do. So I just really support this plan as far as local people being involved.
Thank you. Committee and folks in the audience, some things are unplanned, and we didn't know about this till just a few minutes ago. There's going to be a joint session. The governor is going to address us, kind of a memorial for Special Columbia. which I think we're going to need to be at. We can be here for a couple more minutes because we still have to go through courtesies and the normal process before we get there. I have two people who are from distance that are signed up to testify on the various bills, and I want to give them an opportunity. We have Judy McMakin, who was signed up for 2122, and Gene Cowan, who has signed up for 2128, and I would like to give both you folks a chance to give your testimony, and then we're going to have to cut the rest off.
Mr. Chair, so I know that Commissioner Michael Jordan is here from Clackamas County. Is there any chance you could we could take a couple minutes for his testimony?
Well, we can do that. You know, we're down to you and me, Representative,
okay,
at this point, so please go ahead.
Good morning. I'm Judy McMakin from the Coos County Commission on Children and Families, Chairman Cruz, and Stalhard Representative Tomei. Thank you for being here. Actually, I'm here to speaking on behalf of Jan Kenna, who is the director from Columbia County, and speaking on House Bill 2122.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I will synopsize. Jan speaks to the need to perhaps upgrade or at least consolidate some of our data collection systems. She offers in her testimony to several different ways that folks at the local level who receive funding from different agencies then have to do different data reporting. And she suggests that perhaps a more economical way, as well as a more locally friendly way to do that, would be to consolidate some data systems into one data reporting piece. And so that's basically the recommendation.
We have that written testimony, Mr. Chair.
I've got it right here, and I'll send it forward.
Thank you very much.
I just want to read you one thing from Jan, which I think. Oh, sure. I'm so sorry. Okay. Just read you one thing from Jan that I think you'll enjoy. Fred Meyer can tell you that I buy 8 pints of non-fat, plain Fred Meyer yogurt per month, and when and where the yogurt was made, when it was shipped, and how long it was on the shelf, and the cost per pint. I would like to tell you that 100 youth in Columbia County, ages 12 to 18 years, entered which of our 3 juvenile crime prevention plan services, when and how long they were served, and the outcome of that service. So surely if Fred Meyer can figure out yogurt issues, we can figure out data issues for our local programs that consolidates them. So I hope you'll read Jan's report and enjoy that, and I hope you have a nice day. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I apologize. Gene? And Michael, if you want to come through, that's fine.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning, and thank you for taking a moment with me. I'm Jean Cowan. I'm a county commissioner from Lincoln County. I didn't come today with remarks prepared because I wanted to listen. I came primarily to listen. I can summarize my thoughts later and get them to the committee. I've also passed out a letter at the request of Lane County. We are speaking specifically, I think, to House Bill 2128, which you haven't gotten to yet this morning, but the comments are generic. I have spoken with Commissioner Carlson, and I understand that she and I have a common goal, and that's basically to keep local government in the loop as we move forward in these planning processes, and specifically your local elected officials. So there were some particular things in House Bill 2128 that concerned me greatly, and I understand she has agreed to submit an amendment that would remove sections 1-7, which basically took the elected officials back a step in the process and gave oversight to some of our local decision making. With that removed, and I look a little more closely at Section 8, there's only one piece of specific language that I would respectfully request be changed, and that's in Section 8-2. Items B and D need to be a little more specific in referring to the local public health authority and the local mental health authority rather than the language as it is currently written, local public health agencies and local providers of children's mental health services. The reason I say that is because statutorily, local boards of commissioners are the local public health authority and mental health authority, and that is our statutory requirement. It is our elected requirement. We're responsible to our communities. And I appreciated some of the comments that were made earlier that the county is not a community, but in fact, it is our role as elected officials of the whole county to bring together those various communities and to try to provide as broadly as we can. We do that local coordination in many ways, and we work directly with state agencies. I've been co-chair for some time now of the Local Government Advisory Committee to the Department of Human Services, and have worked directly with three directors of that agency. One of the things that we're trying to build on was the budget note out of the last session that directed that public health and mental health should be part of the process and at the table as budgets were developed in those agencies, and it is my goal that we continue that relationship. But we can't take away the Board of Commissioners' local oversight of plan approval and involvement in this whole process, and probably Lincoln County is the poster child for that. We actually do not have a very well a Commission on Children and Families that functions very well, and it was a result of our ability to step in and provide some oversight that we're now working very hard to bring that up to speed and to make it function better. But there are times when that is our responsibility, and we are the ones who are accountable and need to be our process, our position there needs to be maintained. It was mentioned in the PowerPoint that this was developed under the directions of the local boards of commissioners, and I just encourage you that in any adjustments that you make in these bills that we keep that in mind. They talked about the ability to step we need to have the ability to step in when, although the local Commission on Children and Family is intended to be a convener, they are not bringing all parties to the table, and we need to be able to be part of that process. Although Lincoln County hasn't been functioning as well as it could as a Commission on Children and Families, we've had a local coordination process through our interagency council that's been going on for years before my time, and I've been commissioner for 10 years now. So there's been a great deal of effort to communicate locally, and we need to build on that and keep the board in mind. I heard the comment earlier today that this sounded as if it was more prescriptive, and it is my belief that we do not need to be more prescriptive. We do, in fact, need to be less. And I would refer you to the first paragraph of the Lane County Board of Commissioners letter, which I think says this very, very well, and probably better than I, as I'm trying to read this massive notes that I've made to myself both before and during this session. And I appreciate you taking your time to listen, and what I will do is try to consolidate that into a letter that makes maybe a little more sense than I've just made.
Thank you very much. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, particularly thank you, Carolyn, for your courtesy in requesting I have some time. I will make it extremely short. I also have significant concerns regarding 2128. My understanding, however, is that we're going to work on those issues and straighten those out. However, I would ask that we have the opportunity to submit some comments in writing also regarding the integration of the planning effort. Mr. Chairman, we are the West Coast distributors of planning in this state, and we've done an awful lot of it. I would like to take the opportunity on the record to commend the staff in Clackamas County for their Senate Bill 555 effort, which integrates public health and mental health and law enforcement and all the rest of services delivered to youth. I realize we need to integrate and do a good job. We are concerned, however, about the linkages between planning authority and budget authority, and local versus state authority, and so we'd like the opportunity to look at those and avoid the rule of unintended consequence if we can. Thank you for the time.
Yes, and we would welcome any input we can get on these issues. Committee, for the record, I have a letter from my friend Anna Morrison, Lane County Commissioner, on House Bill 2128, and there's a letter from Jim Seymour from Catholic Community Services on House Bill 2125. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, did the gentleman identify himself? I didn't catch
I'm Mike Jordan, Clackamas County Commissioner.
Thank you.
And I apologize again, but we didn't plan on the shuttle tragedy. We're adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.